go ahead and get started if we could. First off, we appreciate everybody being here tonight. Appreciate Joe showing up. We do have a couple that Andrea Merrill is excused tonight. Melissa Wardell might be a little bit tardy, hoping to be here. But we do appreciate everybody coming here, and those that traveled, both on the division and the public. Appreciate you coming tonight. Thank you. First off, let's go ahead and introduce ourselves here on the right. Tim, let's start with you down here. Tell your name and what you represent.
My name's Tim Nashor. I represent Union Trade.
Joe Arnold, represent public.
Joe Batty, I represent agriculture.
Mitch Hacking, I represent agriculture.
I'm Kevin Elm, I represent the public.
Randy Durth, I'm rap chair.
Boyd Blackwell, the secretary.
Daniel Davis, sportsman.
David Gordon, BLM.
Dan Abeda is our Forest Service representative. I'm sure he'll be here shortly. And Andrea Merrill, she's our non-consumptive representative.
Okay, thank you. First off, we've got some cards out here. If you'd like to give comments here tonight, please fill out one of these cards and bring it up to us. We'll have a comment period. We'll start off with a presentation, and then we'll ask for questions by the RAC, and then questions by the public. And come on in, Dan. Appreciate you coming.
Sorry.
Here. We would ask that when during the question period, those are questions, it's not the comment period. There will be a comment period, so when there's comments, please hold your comments until the comment period. We want to hear everybody's comments, but we do want to follow some kind of an order. So I'm going to ask my illustrious secretary here to be the timekeeper again for us. Everybody on the comment period will get 3 minutes to make their comments. So that kind of goes through the order that we'll do things. When you do have a comment or a question, either one, please step up to this mic right here, state your name, and then go ahead and give us your question or your comment, either one. I think what we'd like to do first off, we've got an agenda, and so we need to approve the agenda. Do I hear a motion to approve the agenda for tonight? Brett Elm made a motion to approve the agenda. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
David Gordon had a second. All in favor?
Aye.
It's unanimous. Let's see. We do have some minutes of our last RAC meeting. I think we hope everybody's had a chance to review those. Is there any additional modifications or changes necessary to those?
There's a few points in there where it says Jerry Prevedel. I believe it was Jerry Jorgensen. I wasn't here last.
Oh, yep.
Last month. So just the last name on a few of them.
Okay.
Jerry's.
Okay. And talk louder.
Thanks, Daniel. We do record everything. So if we don't talk loud enough, then it doesn't get recorded properly. And same with those that step up that mic, please. Please talk loud enough and into the mic. With that, other than the changing Jerry Prevedel to Jerry Jorgensen, do I hear a motion to approve those?
I motion that we go ahead and approve the minutes.
Yeah, it was made by David Gordon. Do I have a second?
Second.
Timmy Nashio seconds that. All in favor?
Yeah.
It's unanimous. Thank you. Give a little Wildlife Board of a meeting update. Wrote a couple things that the, two things, I guess, that Director Sheehan gave us, told us a little bit about. One of them is a shed antler gathering season that they did last year, or this year, I guess. He gave us a few statistics on that. First off, there's about 18,100 people that took the online antler gathering permit And so there is, it is pretty, pretty popular, I guess, across the state. Our conservation officers spend about 3,200 hours out in the field. Directed just at antler gathering. They made about 2,500 contacts. They found about 93 violations and issued 32 citations. So there was a few people out there doing things they shouldn't have been doing, and, but others that maybe didn't know and understand, and they corrected them. Let's see, there was a, as far as motions goes, on the bucks, bulls, and once lifetime permits, that passed just as our RAC approved also, and that passed unanimously 6-0. The antlerless permit recommendation was went just the same way our RAC went, and it passed 6-0. The 2017 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations fell in line with our RAC also, and it passed 6-0. And the 2017 CWMU animal variance request went with our RAC also. So that was a pretty good. Remember that there was one up there by Strawberry Reservoir that there was I think three of the RACs were not in favor. Two RACs were in favor of it, but that ended up passing and going in line with what we suggested also. That passed 6-0. There was a couple of CRC variance request, and that's if somebody wants to do something different in the state than what is normally allowed, they have to go and get a CRC variance. One of them, an individual wanted to commercially use rattlesnakes to train dogs to avoid snakes. So people could hire them to avoid snakes. They want to use their rattlesnakes to do that, and only rattlesnakes. And the Wildlife Board approved that. 6-0. And the second one is a lady in Vegas right now that's moving to Utah, and she wanted to bring a desert tortoise in. That's her pet, and she wanted to bring it into King County, into Utah from King County. And they gave her that variance also at past 6-0. So. That was kind of good. Then one other thing that there was an individual and his father that got into some elk, and this was under the other business. The lawyer provided this, but there was an action item that the Wildlife Board had to do. This individual and his father got into some elk, and they shot a few too many. I think they ended up killing four, and with another blood trail that they were to find the one on the end of that one, if there was one. They'd given him a 3-year suspension, and the father was hoping to make that about a 2-year, 7 months, so he could put back into the draw in 2019. And the Wildlife Board approved that. The son didn't apply for that, and so he didn't. That was just the problem. That's actually a pass 4-3, and I took the chairman's tiebreaker vote to pass that one. That's the Wildlife Board update. We'll go on to a regional supervisor, Boyd Blackwell, so we can get an update. What's going on here in our region?
We've got a lot of things going on. Our wildlife section, they're out today and they'll be out there for a couple of days. They're doing a bison capture and collaring project. They're going to be using GPS collars. They'd like to get a better understanding on movement and locations at different times of the years, where these bison are and where they're going and what they're doing. They're just wrapped up their sage grouse counts. We don't have all of the data in yet, but it looks like they're down a little bit compared to last year. Could be maybe a cause of all of the snow, but we're not quite sure of that yet. But they just got through that, and they're also just wrapping up their spring classifications. They don't have the data in yet to report on what they've found. Our aquatic section, they've been out for a couple of weeks doing some stream rehab projects for Colorado cutthroat trout. They've done a really nice job in some of the areas that they've worked. They've put in what we call fish hotels, where they go into these banks and they'll dig out these banks and you put some wood across there and then bring it back down and put their detreated posts and they put juniper roots in there so it acts to hold and big boulders. And so they've been doing that for Colorado cuts, and they've done a very good job there. We're excited to see those and see how they're working. I went out and observed the project Thursday, and fish were already starting to use these fish hotels. They put in well over 30 of these fish hotels on this stream. So they've been really busy. A little bit here regarding some of our planned stocking for this year. We already received almost half of our quota this year of sterile walleye. We've had some problems with the fish cooperating for whatever reason. The males and the females were just had a difficult time coordinating their efforts. And so we're cut back. Our final tally on that right now is 195,590. We had a goal of 520,000. So we're significantly lower. I don't know if that's going to change much now. It's a little bit late. We stocked 555 yellow perch and about 250 black crappie up in Red Fleet. The perch came from the Big Sand Wash here in the region, and the crappie came from Pine View. We'll be making another trip out to Pine View to get some more crappie, and on May 23rd and 24th. The weather has really been the big thing on the crappie. With the cooler temperatures that we had, the fish are staying deeper, and so the guys have to try and get the fish at a certain elevation so that you don't blow the bladder when you're reeling them up, and they have an easier mortality if that happens. Tiger trout will go in today, and wipers will go in July. Our law enforcement folks, we're currently down an officer. Shane decided to move to warmer climates from Daggett. He went down to St. George, and I think he'll find that it's a lot more comfortable up here than it is down in St. George in the summertime, maybe not in the wintertime, but that's what's going on. With our law enforcement, our habitat section, they also spent the last couple of weeks out. They were working down on Meadow Creek, out in the Book Cliffs on our WMA. They did several brush treatments, some fence repairs, and did a lot of work irrigating and getting water out on that lower pastures down there at Meadow Creek to get those greened up and get them a jump start in their growth. But that's everything, unless you guys have any questions.
What stream was that? Those fish hotels? You said that those stream was out?
I can't remember right off. I'd have to. Don't worry, it wasn't on the forest.
Careful.
I think it might have been that Christmas.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was.
All right.
Sure. All right. Thank you. Appreciate that update. All right. I think we're up for our first action item. We'll turn the time to Jason Robinson. for our outdoor game and turkey hunt. Table recommendations presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator of the Salt Lake office. Going to be talking about Upland Game and turkeys tonight. So one of the things I like to do is talk a little bit about the biology of Upland Game. Upland Game are very different from big game, both biologically and how we manage them. And so it's a completely different system. And so a little bit of background is a little bit helpful for folks. Upland Game experience boom and bust cycles and are generally short-lived. Many of the species live less than 2 years. Populations are largely dependent on annual production and less so on survival. Natural annual survival rates can be range anywhere from 10 to 40%. So another way of saying that is in a totally healthy pheasant population, 80% of the birds can die each year and then they're replaced. So you can see there's a quick turnover for a lot of upland game species. And what that relates ultimately amounts to is hunter harvest generally accounts for less than 10% of the population's annual mortality rate. So population cycle largely independent of hunter harvest. We use the term this law of diminishing returns. In simplified form, if populations of upland game are up because of weather or climate or whatever reasons, hunters will go out, have a real successful hunt, come back, tell their friends. The friends are more likely to go out and go hunting. When populations are low, that same hunter goes out, maybe not successful, tells their friends, wasn't a great hunt. They're less likely to go. And so what you see is hunter harvest and hunter participation trends very well with populations. And so there's this inherent protection in there. The other thing we do with upland game is we have longer seasons and more liberal bag, which spreads the harvest and opportunity out over both time and space. So what this all kind of comes down to is a three-year guidebook, which we're asking you to approve tonight, makes sense biologically. It also makes sense administratively. Because it's a three-year guidebook, and some of the species have, we're recommending fixed season date openers, on occasion, those dates can fall on a Sunday, and because we can't have a hunt open on a Sunday here in Utah, when that does happen, we'd like to recommend moving the opener from that Sunday to the Monday, the day after. So, for example, September 1st of 2019 falls on a Sunday. We're recommending moving that to September 2nd, the Monday after. So jumping right into the recommendations, we have 20 upland game species we're going to cover tonight. And so what I'll do is, on species that we're not recommending any changes, I'll go a little bit quicker on those. And then on the species that we're recommending a change, I'll slow down and talk about that change and some of the justification. So California and Gambel's quail, we are not recommending any changes for those birds. It's a statewide hunt with a youth hunt and a 5-daily bag. Chukar and gray partridge, or huns, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 5-daily bag for each species. Ringneck pheasant, this is a species we are recommending a change. We're recommending just going with a statewide hunt. In the past, we've had two seasons. The first part of the season was a two-week season that was open statewide. The second 2 weeks of the season, private land were closed. And what we've seen last couple of years is that's causing a lot of confusion with some of our hunters, especially our walking access properties that are technically private land, but they are open during that extended season. Pheasants Forever approached us to see if we could do something to make that simpler and easier to understand. And so what we're recommending is just a statewide hunt that opens on the first Saturday in November to the first Sunday in December. And then continue with the youth hunt and a bag limit of 2 males. Dusky and rough grouse, the forest grouse, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a 4-daily bag. Greater sage grouse, we're not recommending any changes there. We would like to continue with a permit allocation system. And just for clarification, most of the state is closed to greater sage grouse hunting with four areas open. And statewide harvest is less than 3% of the statewide population. We'd like to continue to allocate 15% of those permits to youth. So that's the four areas currently open, with a yearly bag of two birds per hunter per year. Sharptail grouse, very similar to sage grouse. No recommendation for a change there. We'd like to continue the permit allocation system with 15% of those permits going to youth. There's two areas open in the state, both in the northern region, with a bag of two birds per year. White-tailed ptarmigan, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a four daily bag. Wild turkeys, we manage turkeys a little bit differently than some of the other upland game species. So with turkeys on the spring hunt, we evaluate three performance targets and then see if those are triggered in any one year. Those three performance targets are, we look at the three-year average of hunter success. We want that to be greater than 20%. We look at the three-year average of hunter crowding. We want that to be less than 4 on a 1-5 scale. Three-year average hunter satisfaction. We want that to be greater than 2 on a 1-5 scale. So looking at the data, so that yellow line shows the total permits. The black line shows total harvest. 2010 is when we implemented the over-the-counter general season. You can see for the last 4 years, we've had an increasing trend in both hunters and turkey harvest. The hunter success rate, three-year average, is 32.3%. So that's above the 20%. So that trigger has not been met. Three-year average hunter satisfaction is 3.8. That's above the 2, so that trigger has not been met. Hunter crowding, three-year average is 2.2. So that's below 4, so that trigger has not been met. This graph's probably of note. The green line there shows the number of hunters afield. And you can see that, again, that increasing trend the last few years. But what's interesting is even though we've been putting more hunters out in the field, the hunters are not feeling crowded. Their crowding index is staying the same. And there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One is hunters are pretty good at dispersing themselves into different canyons. And we've also been expanding turkey populations. And so we have more areas for hunters to go and pursue turkeys. So to kind of sum up all that data, hunters are being successful, they're satisfied, and they're not feeling crowded. So based on all of that, we're not recommending any changes to the spring wild turkey permit or seasons. So we would like to continue with the limited entry hunt with 15% going to the youth. And then following that, we'll have a youth three-day hunt and then the general statewide hunt that's unlimited permits over the counter. So again, no recommended changes. The fall wild turkey season. This main objective of this hunt is to reduce human-turkey conflicts. In many parts of the state, we're still trying to grow turkey populations, but in a couple parts of the state, we have a few too many turkeys that we're trying to reduce that a little bit, and we're using hunters to do that. So we're not recommending any changes to this. It seems to be working well. Snowshoe hare. This is, we're not recommending any changes to the snowshoe hare season. It's a statewide hunt with a five daily bag. Cottontail rabbits, not recommending any changes there. It's a statewide hunt with a 10 daily bag. Falconry recommendation, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a 6-month season. Shifting gears a little bit. So within the Upland Game Guidebook, there are 5 species of migratory upland game birds, and those birds are managed through essentially the flyway, the federal system, and are managed through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so there's additional stipulations on those species above and beyond just state regulations. I've got Blair Stringham here. He's our migratory game bird coordinator. If there's specific questions, he can help address those. So those 5 species that fall under this category are band-tailed pigeon, sandhill crane, American crow, mourning dove, and white-winged dove. In addition to the additional federal regulations, they also require a HIP number, Harvest Information Program number. And we're going to be making some changes this year for that system. And so these are required for the five migratory upland game birds, waterfowl, and geese. We're going to change how hunters get their permits. We're going to move to an online system where a hunter can get their HIP number on their smartphone in the field or on their home computer. It's going to take effect this fall, in August, prior to the dove hunt. Essentially what this is going to do is it's going to make it much faster and easier for hunters to be able to get their HIP number. And so we just want to make you guys aware of that. So moving into the recommendations, fantail pigeon, we're not recommending any changes there. A hunter must obtain a free fantail pigeon permit. It's a statewide hunt with a two-daily bag. Sandtail crane, this is one that we are recommending a change. So there's no change being recommended for Rich, Cache, or East Boxilla County. We met with some of the folks here in the basin about cranes. A few of you are here on the rack tonight to talk about maybe shifting the hunt a little bit later to see if we could get that hunt to overlap when the cranes are here in this part of the state. And so what we're recommending is for three seasons, an early, a mid, and a late, with 10 days long for each of the season, with the first season starting on the Saturday closest to October 1, and then each of those seasons would run after that, with a season bag or a yearly bag of one bird per year. Mourning and whitening doves, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a September 1 through October 30th, statewide with a 15 bag. American crow, we're not recommending any changes there. That's a statewide hunt with a daily bag of 10. Migratory upland game recommendation, we're not recommending any changes there for the falconry migratory. We have a couple of board action items that the board asked us to look into, so we're taking it through this rack and we'll present it at the next board meeting. The first board action item is youth hunts on WMAs for upland game. So we put together of all the opportunities youth have for upland game hunting from the 2016 season, and that's provided in your rack packet. And we are recommending one change based on that information. We're recommending to close the Pavant and Annabella WMAs, both in the southern region, to the general public on the second Saturday of November for a youth pheasant hunt. It's a long-running hunt that's been going on for a number of years, and what we'd like is just to be able to have the ability to put that in the guidebook and make people aware so they don't accidentally show up and there's a youth hunt and not be able to hunt. The second board action item, the board asked us to look at the order of the turkey hunts, specifically look at eliminating the limited entry turkey draw and replace it with over the counter. As I presented earlier, we are not recommending any changes to that. To sum it up once again, hunters are being successful, they're not feeling crowded, and they're satisfied. We've met with various groups and hunters around the state, and the most common comment we're getting back is folks like the current structure. And so we're not recommending any changes there. A couple of housekeeping items. Rule 657-6, taking upland game. We made some minor editorial corrections, made some corrections and clarifications on baiting upland game. Rule 657-54, taking wild turkeys. Made some minor editorial corrections and some corrections and clarification on baiting wild turkeys. And that language is provided in your rack packet. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Jason. Thank you. All right. Questions by the rack. I know I've got a couple of questions. I'll kind of leave it off first here. But the last one where you had the Pavana and Annabella, tell me how that would work. Is that the closed, but it would just be the youth be able to go on it, or they got to draw a permit to go on it?
So what we do is we have youth sign up for the hunt through our regional office. And it would be open to those folks that have signed up, and then closed to anyone else that would want to come and try and hunt.
Are those areas big enough that everybody who signs up can do it, or is it kind of a first come, first serve type thing?
We can accommodate most people between the two hunt areas. I think we can get the vast majority of folks. There's been a couple of years where it was real popular where we had to turn a couple of folks away, youth away. But for the most part, we can accommodate them.
Okay, thank you. Second question I got is we have the four hunts as far as sage grouse goes. And what is that permit process? Is it an online application for that process? Or how does it sound like those are kind of special permits? How does that work?
Yeah, so it operates more similar to like a big game draw where you apply through a drawing and then we randomly select people that draw the permits. There's a point system associated with that. And what we see most years, most of the units, about half of the applicants draw. There is the east or the west Box Elder County that generally has a couple of permits left over that can be then purchased after the draw.
I'm just curious if there's overcrowding on something like that. The whole state converted on four places and people wanted to have that.
We regulate that very carefully based on LEC counts. So we use the spring data to determine the number of permits for that year. And then we it's a very conservative harvest. So we generally don't have much of an issue with crowding.
Thank you. Other questions on that? Matt, Mitch, and then Tim.
Yes, sir. Well, this will kind of spin off your question. Jason, explain to me, on the sage grouse, here we've got a bird that's just about on the endangered species list. Is that correct?
It was determined to not be warranted for listing.
Right. That's the next step to get on the endangered species list. Now, is it open to falconry?
It is, yes.
It's open to falconry. Okay. Maybe explain to me. The sage grouse requires a special permit. And the sandhill crane requires a special permit. Okay, on the sage grouse, the hunter can have a bag limit of two per year on their sage grouse. And on these sandhill cranes, you've got thousands of birds up and down the Green River corridor causing havoc with their farms and their ranchers. But yeah, we can only have one bag limit, one bird, and it's closed to falconry. Can you explain that to me?
So it gets into a state managed species and a federally managed species. Essentially what we have is the state has the authority over sage grouse to determine how the hunt should be structured and what to do there. With cranes, it's a bit different. It's managed through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so there's more stipulations there than we have in the state.
You gentlemen don't have any input or any way to change the bag limit at all?
I'll have Blair come up. He's our representative on the flyway for migratory species, which cranes fall under.
He's got a few scars on
it. Blair Strick, your name, would you please?
Yeah, Blair Strick, I'm the
Blair, turn the mic on. Just
okay.
Yeah. It's not, yeah, just slide it up.
All right. So, Blair Stringham. So, the way we manage cranes, we get a specific allocation for how many we can harvest each year. And so, we've limited hunters to only be able to take one crane just so we can provide out opportunity. Generally, it takes hunters a couple of years to draw a crane permit, so we've tried to reduce the number they can harvest so that other people can have a chance at it.
It looks to me you're putting the same value on a crane if you're doing on these sage chickens, but we put thousands of dollars in to try to save and keep off that endangered species. It just doesn't add up. The agriculture people, it's hard for us to make this add up.
So as far as you want an additional harvest, is that?
Well, you got a higher bag limit on the sage grouse than you do the crane.
So
the sage grouse, you can have the 500. You don't even do that with the cranes.
Right.
They're treated better than the saints, too.
And really? What it comes down to is, I guess, just kind of the harvest potential for the overall population. So that's essentially what Jason does with his model. And he looks at the potential for harvest for sage grouse across the state and then divvies out the permits for each one of the regions based on how many he estimates we can harvest. Mm-hmm. So we do a similar process with that through the flyway for the population of sandhill cranes. It's just on that larger scale.
I know.
So we're looking at essentially half of the western United States that have sandhill cranes currently. and looking at how many we can harvest. And then that number that can be harvested from the overall population is divvied out for percentage for each one of the states on how many they can shoot. So based on our percentage, we get, say, out of the 20,000 cranes that are out there, we can harvest, say, 200 this year. So we divide that out between our hunters. We could potentially give them up to, I think, 3 permits if we wanted to, but we could never harvest more than that 200 birds that would have out of the cage. So
the federal people have got you stuck there. You're pretty well tied in.
There is some flexibility. I mean, Jason talked about the season dates, so we can modify those. There's, you know, other things like that that we can modify, but the harvest is based off of data that we collect each year instead of farming last month.
Let's put those cranes on the endangered species.
We should try it.
I wouldn't guarantee. Thank you, Blair. Ken, you got a question?
Yeah, I have a question on the turkeys. You guys open that up, like the over-the-counter? You guys are going to wipe them birds out around here.
So, just to kind of reiterate, that we've had an over-the-counter season since 2010.
Well, I can agree with the one that you got right now, because the birds ain't, you know, they ain't really mating. You know, that the burst of the like, over the draw limit you got, if you give them out over-the-counter at that time, you guys are going to wipe them birds out.
So we're not recommending any changes from the current system. Is that...
I'm just wondering, Tim, are you thinking that in this region that they're going to have a fall over the counter now?
No, I thought he was saying something about changing the limited draw to over the counter at the same time.
No, the board asked us to look into that that option, and we are recommending not going that route. So we're recommending keeping everything the same as it currently is.
I'm with you on that.
Okay.
Other questions by the rocks?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go.
On the crane hunt in New England County, we're having 3 10-day hunts. Is that correct?
That's what we're recommending.
Can we separate those a little bit so they run consecutively with a 5 or 10-day rest period so we can get just a little bit later to move some of those birds out of the area?
Let me pull Blair up here again. Just to keep it in his realm.
Yeah, so this is again one of those things that we discussed this last winter. Currently, we're restricted to have a 30-day consecutive hunt, so whenever we start that, it can only run for 30 days and they have to be consecutive. We're currently working within the planning process to expand that to be longer than 30 days. And so if we do get to that point where the Fish and Wildlife Service allows us to do that, then we would certainly love to have a hunt that's longer than 30 days. But currently, that is what we're restricted to.
Could we start it later?
Yeah, yep. So we could definitely, I think if we can start any time between the first part of September all the way through January. And so based off the feedback from the group that we had earlier this winter, we determined that October is probably the best time to have that.
But it has to be consecutive,
yeah.
Right?
Yep. So as Jason pointed out, I think this year it starts on like the end of September, like the 28th. So if we start on the 28th, we could only run for 30 days at the max, and they kind of run into, say, November, break into the segment for it.
The cranes are a real issue here in our area. Doing a lot of damage to the agriculture. There was a special crane meeting held this past winter with the smaller landowners and the division trying to figure out how we can eliminate some of these cranes out here and do it the right way, so we'll move them out. Another question, by the way.
Yes, on the pheasant hunt or the other hunts, so you said if it starts on a Sunday, we'll move to Monday. Why not Saturday?
So the best example of that is the dove hunt. We can't open a migratory bird hunt, which doves fall under that category, prior to September 1. So to make it easier for hunters, so we don't have one hunt opening on Saturday and then another one hunting on open on Monday, we found it easier for hunters to just open them all on the Monday following. And that's what we've done in the past, and it's been pretty worked pretty well.
What about the pheasant hunt, the one you're proposing going a month?
So with the pheasants, the date is actually always on a Saturday. So the recommendation is to have it be always open on that first Saturday in November.
Because you're not guidelined to buy the federal government on the flyway because of the doves.
Correct.
The question I've got is on that youth pheasant hunt in the southern region on the Vermont, Annabella. That sounds like, is it going to be like right in the middle of November, second Saturday? Or?
Yeah, so it's the second Saturday, so it is during the general season pheasant hunt.
Has that traditionally been how it's worked down there, or is that a new thing? Or?
That's how it's traditionally been. They've been doing it over 10 years that I know of. I'm pretty sure longer than that.
Okay. I'm just curious because I know they do one here in this region, and it's mid-October?
Yeah, that one occurs. We have a youth pheasant hunt weekend that the hunt in this region occurs during that. But because this hunt down in the southern region predates when we did the youth weekend, they prefer to keep it on the same day for tradition.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Another question, Brother Rock.
Maybe just one more question on pheasants. Have you, I'm sure you have, studied a little bit of the bird farms and their impact as far as the opening dates and closing dates on bird populations and how they affect them? I think they open September 1st through March 31st, and what you believe that impact is to be able to hunt pheasants somewhat in the wild, and what that may have as far as an effect on the wild populations.
Yeah, so any of those commercial hunting areas or pheasant clubs, when they apply each year or every third year, and when they first apply, we evaluate the potential to have an impact on wild pheasant populations in that surrounding area. So our biologists basically review the application to make sure that the impacts will either be none or very minimal. In addition, some of those birds, they're not allowed to harvest 100% of the birds they release. And so if they are harvesting a handful of wild birds, they're also allowing some of the pen-raised birds to go into the wild as well. So overall, we don't think it has any net effect on the wild population.
Okay. Last question, and I'm a bird hunter, and that's why. But any thought or discussion about the raptors and their effects and anything that you would be able to do from the division on birds of prey on populations?
Not specifically for reducing raptors. The best thing we can do is create more and better habitat for the birds so they have places to hide. Again, raptors are a federally managed species as well. You'll hear a lot more about that here coming up. But as far as from our standpoint, what we try and do is most of these game birds that I'm talking about are prey for those naturally, and that's fine. It's the whole circle of life. And so what we try and do is address that through habitat work and creating more and better habitat.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have one question.
Yeah.
On the crowding rating, like from 1 to 5, is that like satisfaction, basically?
It's
kind
the same.
Type of scale, just.
Yep. So,
how do you feel?
Feeling very satisfied or very crowded.
Okay.
Crowded, satisfied, neutral.
Okay.
It's a pretty basic question.
Yeah.
But it gives us really good data.
Any questions about the Rory, could we get you to bring us that to comment card before we start that? All right, let's go to comments or questions. Questions by the public on this one. Anybody have any questions on this one? Remember our, if you would, come on up the microphone, and remember this is question period, not comments. State your name. And
Edward Henderson. And I'd like to direct the question. Let me give a background to the question. We have been led to believe in the Falkland community that the restriction on not being able to use falcons.
Would you address your question?
Yeah.
Vaguely?
Yeah.
Here.
And speak into the mic.
The only one there can answer.
Okay. Actually, I asked him this question last night, and he was saying that it was a federal restriction, and he hasn't had time to get me the thing back. But in as much as it was with an, with migratory bird, I asked Mr. Stringham here, and the question, I guess, would be, is it a federal restriction? And your answer is it's not.
Yeah, so I guess because it is a federal thing, as it falls more in my background and expertise, and so last night when they asked if it was, Jason wasn't for sure what the answer was. But when we were putting the draft packet and stuff together, we were under the impression that falconers weren't allowed to take cranes. We've researched that and talked with the feds, and it looks like they are allowed to do that. And so that's a change that we do intend to make for the board presentation, is to take that language out that Jason had there about not allowing falconers to take cranes. And currently, they, and in the past, they have been involved in that as well.
If I could then ask the question, if the RAC here could actually have that as an exception on here when they approve the presentation,
except for walking birds. Roy, did you get his name? Can you tell us your name one more time?
Duard
Pedersen. You've probably never heard of Duard before.
D-U-A-R-D.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. I did miss that. I heard it. I just wasn't sure, I guess. Any other questions by the public? All right, thank you. We do have one comment, so we'll ask you to come up, and I'll have our illustrious secretary here time us. We do have 3 minutes for that. Blake, we got you. Blake Best.
Blake Best. I'm representing the National Wild Turkey Federation tonight. I serve on the state board, representing northeastern Utah here. We'd just like to say we're in full support with the DWR's recommendation on the turkey hunt. Jason and these guys have put in a lot of time and effort on making this hunt right. And we don't want to see all the turkeys get wiped out, and that's why they're going forward with keeping the limited entry hunt, so the sportsman has a chance for a trophy and yet opportunity for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Blake. I'll just make a comment. I participated in my first turkey hunt ever this year. My son drew a tag, and I happened to go with him, and it was an experience that we had a good time. I mean, it was fun, and that WMA over in Bitter Creek had 4 groups on it when I went, and we wasn't even hunting. We were just driving through, but we had 4 groups on that one. It was kind of fun to see. All right, I'm not hearing any more comments from this Jason, so we'll turn it back to the RAC for discussion. I guess I got a couple questions, and it sounds like that one part of the presentation you're going to change for the board. So I don't know if you guys have agreed on that. There's probably no sense in us trying to make a motion to that.
You guys can address that if you want to. So in the RAC packet on the Sandhill Crane Falconry portion, it says no falconry. And as Blair stated, that's an error. Falconry can't be allowed on cranes.
Okay. Well, that might be one thing we talked about. The second thing, I guess, I got was there any hot topics that the other RACs, I think we're the last RAC, any other hot topics that the other RACs touched on that we haven't?
No, I think so far all of them have passed the recommendation as presented unanimously.
Okay, thank you. All right, discussion by the RAC. Joe.
I would really like to see us extend the Sandhill Crane Hunt, give us more opportunity to move more birds out of the area. And so, after somebody makes the motion to accept this, I'm going to make an amendment to that motion that we extend that there be a resting period between the crane hunts to give us more opportunity as those birds come flying in to move more of them on out of there.
Would it be easier to push the season start date later?
I would like it later, but I think there's those in Jensen who would prefer it where it's at.
What you got is the summer is the chopper corn when the cranes come in early in September. These guys, they thrash the corn. So that's kind of what he was working on for there.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, one of the things that you might consider, if that's the direction you'd like to go, Joe, because the federal agency holds us to a 30-day, a minimum or maximum 30 days. So that's all we can hunt. And it has to be consecutive. Now, what you could do is possibly phrase this to ask the division to pursue when Blair goes to his federal meetings, to ask the feds if we can have an extended hunt and if we can have a rest period between on those in that 30 days, or if we can have it extended longer, to ask him to take a look at it. Because if you don't do it that way, we'll kind of waste it, because there's nothing that we can do at this point. But if you were to ask the division to look at that and address it when he goes to his flyway meetings, the board would probably say, yeah, that's a good idea.
Blair, are you aware that we're getting local birds? Birds that are nesting here?
Yeah, and so I can probably look at more background. So currently, I put together a proposal that will be discussed in August to do away with that 30-day rule. So essentially allow us to have basically as long a season as we would like if it goes through. So we could potentially have a season from September through December if we wanted to. So that's currently what we're working towards. In regards to your question, I guess I have a question for you guys. Are you looking at essentially crane hunt being different and earlier in the Jensen area and then wanting it to be later in the Oray area? Is that what I was understanding from your comment earlier?
No, I don't believe so. If we did what I'd like, we'd start the 1st October, 10 days, rest 10 days, hunt 10 days, rest 10 days, and then hunt 10 days. And that would give us a lot longer season. But apparently the federal does not allow us to do that.
Yeah, it currently doesn't. We could look at doing that, though, if we could have longer than 30 days. And I guess, would you want to have rest periods in there? Or if we could have for longer than 30 days, just hunt the whole time, would that be better for you guys?
I think the greater success rate and the greater opportunity to flush the birds out would be the rest period.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely doable in what we're trying to do right now with the Fish and Wildlife Service. But I think in the meantime, it would definitely be appropriate to make an action item for you guys to track for us to look at doing that and pursue it when the opportunity presents itself.
Excuse me, I got a question for you. How would the tribe do about getting some of those tags?
It's a different process. It's actually outside of the allocation process that we're working on for this hunting season. Tribes typically work directly with the Fish and Wildlife Service to get.
Is there any way I can get a number from you so we can contact?
I'll see if I can find that and provide them
for it. I've been trying to get our biologists to get into it, and I think if we could get into it, I think, you know, with the both of us entities going out, I think we could probably put a dent.
Yeah, I can definitely.
I have a question. Does the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, do they allow any depredation?
They do. So that's separate, again, from this hunting opportunity. Fish and Wildlife, or the Wildlife Services typically comes out and addresses damage complaints. If they're severe enough, they can apply to have depredation permits for microbes. And that's completely separate from the hunting aspect. So.
Blaine, did anybody get any this fall?
Not that I'm aware of. I know we talked about it probably, when was that, January? So it was after.
Did anybody in Jensen choose anybody to apply? Did they go through the process?
I don't think anybody out here has applied or tried to go through the process other than possibly this spring when we had talked. And The only ones I'm aware of that are currently done in the state, there was someone in Utah County that did it last year.
But nobody here's done it. Actually, had a meeting and we've got stuff to
it. I'm not aware of anybody that's successfully got the permits, but I know we had talked about you.
Did anybody submit it?
I haven't seen anything, but typically Wildlife Services takes care of that process, and so they haven't talked to me about anybody trying to apply, but they very well could have.
I think we ought to have some kind of an action item here and a motion made on it just to bring it to the attention of the Wildlife Board so that they can be primed and pumped on it, because it is a real issue for the folks here in this area. So whether it's an amendment to this one or a whole other motion, I think either one will do it. But, I think you're on track.
What do you think would be best, Mr. Chairman?
I think it would be best to just set the motion on that.
Okay, we're on that issue right now. I'll make the motion that we at least address changing the 30 consecutive day sandhill crane hunt to run for 10 days, rest 10 days, run 10 days, rest 10 days, and then run 10 more days to give us greater opportunity to flush the birds out of the area.
You get that, Rory? Okay. I've got a motion. I have a second.
I'll second.
Mitch Hack again, second on that. Any discussion? All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It is unanimous. Thank you. All right, back to the original action item here, which was the open game and turkey hunt table recommendations. Do we have any other discussion on that? If not, I'll call for a motion on that.
I motion that we go ahead and approve, as presented, with the caveat that they make the correction and allow falconry to take cranes.
That was made by David Gordon. The motion was to allow the recommendations as is, with the exception of taking cranes with falcons, which is going against the presentation just ahead, I guess. We have a second. Timmy Nash, your second. Any discussion? All in favor? Unanimous? All right, thank you, appreciate it, Jason. Okay, up next we've got Russ Norvell with the, he's our, Indian?
Yep.
Conservation Program Coordinator. We'll be a faculty ruling member.
Good evening. This is my first RAC tour, and although it's the fifth RAC meeting now, this is going to be an interesting one for all y'all as well. Give you some background on the sport of falconry. This is the sport of kings, practiced for thousands of years on most every continent. In Utah currently, however, it's a relatively small sportsman's group of 253 permitted falconers with roughly 276 permitted individual birds. That represents roughly 26 species in use. 16 of these are native to North America. The rest are non-native or hybrid species. 5 of those 26 are considered to be conservation status species. So they have either threatened or endangered species, a state sensitive species, a conservation agreement species like the goshawk of the Forest Service, or they're a Fish and Wildlife Service bird of conservation concern, which is the de facto candidate species list. About half those individual birds are captive bred, too. In 2008, the states were granted authority to administer falconry by the federal government, with the federal rule providing the basement it's a kind of a one-size-fits-most approach, where the states are allowed to deal with specific local issues as needed. This particular rule has not been revised in over 5 years, and we have some new conservation needs and some resolved concerns and some structural issues that we have to be dealt with. So Utah's rule's primary purpose is to govern the take of protected wildlife, including the collection and possession of falconry birds and the take of game animals. In rule, we define falconry as the caring for and training raptors for the pursuit of wild game and for the hunt and for hunting wild game with raptors.
Yeah.
The possession of non-suitable species of raptors that are not suitable for falconry is primarily governed by the CIP rule, the collection, importation, and possession rule. The sport of falconry, this presentation covers three primary themes: hunting with raptors, the take of raptors from the wild, and the care of raptors. It also covers a variety of other wide-ranging activities, including the importation of non-native species that are otherwise prohibited by the CIP rule. It covers abatement activities, such as flying falcons at airports, so we're essentially sanctioning a business practice with this rule. It also allows for captive propagation, so you can capture wild raptors from the wild, enter them into a captive propagation program, and then sell the progeny, for example. So hunting with raptors. The state considers raptors to be a type of allowable weapon, like any other hunt. The rule allows for, unusually though, the take of protected game species, primarily Jason's and Blair's upland game and waterfowl, but also allows for the take of unprotected species and for the creation of special hunting seasons, ad hoc seasons for falconry use by the division director of the Wildlife Board. The take of wild raptors for falconry is limited, however, by a variety of other laws. Most basically, it's also the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that Blair was just discussing, but also the federal falconry rule itself, the Endangered Species Act, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, as we mentioned, the Federal Birds of Conservation Concern List, and by tradition and history, it also the falconer experience level, and also more recently, the state conservation concerns. Care of raptors is also covered by this rule extensively. Most of this language comes directly from our federal rule, the standards for care, the standards for the facilities that the raptors are housed in, and for facilities and provides for facilities inspection, which is a sensitive area given that oftentimes, or many often, very often, raptors are actually housed in people's homes. So our current rule has three experience-based classes of falconry permits. You got the apprentice, allowed one bird of a few species, typically adult birds only. It's a 3-year apprenticeship. The general class falconer can have up to 3 birds with many more species and many more ages of birds. So that's a 5-year minimum period. A master falconer can have multiple birds from anything on the authorized species list. There's an asterisk there for the eagle endorser, which is we've generalized with this rule revision to include basically all large raptors, think like aircraft carriers. These are bigger than a breadbox. Birds require special handling skills and special facilities for handling these red large raptors, like golden eagles, which is what we've used before. The list of authorized species for each class is important for legal conservation and practical reasons, and we're going to hear, I think, a lot more about this later tonight as well. So our current rule has some fundamental issues. It's based on the federal standard, which I mentioned is kind of a one-size-fits-some approach. We found it to be hard to follow, hard to enforce, and hard to administer as well. And our current rule is, quite honestly, it's long, it's complicated, and it's somewhat unique in terms of rules in the division. Because we're using native and non-native birds to take protected wildlife, we allow possession of non-native species that would be otherwise prohibited from importation into the state. We allow take of high priority conservation species, which, for example, that's an activity that would be prohibited to an oil and gas operator, say. It also allows for special ad hoc licenses, locations, and seasons. So our goals for the revision process were to invite the public into the process to have kind of a no surprises approach, I think we will cover this in some detail. Our goal was to simplify the rule and to clarify the language and intent, and ideally to shorten it. I don't think we fell a bit short on that goal in the end, but and we also wanted to make it easier to use, both for falconers to comply with, for our law enforcement to be able to enforce, and for us to administer as well. So our first goal in the public engagement, we held a number of informal outreach meetings with open houses, over 10 other meetings with the Utah Falconry Association and other individual falconers. We've also reached out to Audubon groups as well, although not as actively. We addressed over 60 specific issues. We have addressed issues with administrative procedures as well, how the rule was actually implemented. And we've had considerable consultation with the falconry community and responded to literally hundreds of comments. We've worked to simplify the rule by clarifying the language and intent. If you've looked at your packet, you've seen there's the red line copy is full of red ink. So there's a lot of edits there. So we've grouped like sections to streamline the rule. We've rewritten whole sections to clarify the intent. Updated it to match the Fish and Wildlife Service's Birds of Conservation Concern list, the BCC list. And this is worth clarifying that we're working under currently a 2008 BCC list that has 11 species that are germane to that are relevant to Utah. There is a 20, I believe their official of the service finished a draft in 2015, sent out for review in 16, and we are all waiting for the service to approve this list in DC right now. And we like the changes that will drop us down to four species for Utah and a lot less geographic restrictions, because a lot of our species have recovered. Their population is doing fine here, and we'd like to see that reflected in the BCC list. We've also updated references to the upland game rule, the pen-reared bird rules to stay consistent with other state rules. The last thing is to make it easier to use. We clarified processes and lines of authority. There's a lot here, but fundamentally, we updated the administrative processes and methods. We have built a formal database, finally. It's doing some basic stuff you think we'd have done before, but we've corrected contact information. We've added an email list. We've updated all the forms to web forms, so we're bringing things up into the internet age. We've also added language to protect falconers in case a bird's conservation status changes. So if a listed falconer has a bird and it gets listed as a T&E species, they're protected. We've added take of adult American kestrels, breeding adults. That's something that's allowed by federal rule. That only applies to general and master class falconers. And this is because it was an issue that was brought to us by the UFA, because it's a hard piece of the rule that's hard to comply with and also hard to enforce. And we've also clarified the lines of authority so that it only derives from the division director of the Wildlife Borough Board, not the program coordinator, which the current rule incorrectly points out. So in sum, we got a bunch of small changes. Initially, the rule was shortened by over 5 pages. In the last redline copy, I think we edged back, lost some of that ground. We have well over 80, I think over 100 edits and corrections at this point. Again, to clarify the intent, we updated citations, fixed confusing sentences. The most important thing we did, though, and the most controversial thing here tonight, is that we incorporated the pre-authorized species list into the table. It's a table into the text of the rule itself. That's to bring our rule construction into current standard how rules are constructed. This table of pre-authorized species had been on the website sitting beside the rule. That was an improper construction, and puts us into an awkward situation where we probably have a rule that's unenforceable as it's currently written. All these changes set us up for some other things that aren't in the rule itself. Shifting to online COR applications, this will allow us to add falconer CORs to the DWR mobile app. Shifting to online annual reporting, and also to update the falconer database itself using the web forms. So the big changes, and I apologize, but this is presentation varies a little bit from your packet. We've responded to some questions along the way, the last few racks, and I think it helps to clarify, get a better discussion too. So I've made a couple changes. to the presentation, just to clarify. However, the rule you're voting on is identical. That has not changed, just the presentation. So the bigger changes, we've increased the number of pre-authorized species from our policy and practice. The federal rule allows for any of three families of hawks, eagles, or falcons, and most of these are non-native. We're talking over 500 raptors worldwide. Our rule now pre-authorizes 32 non-native species and 23 native raptors, and defines a process by which more can be added by appealing to the division director without having to go through the wildlife board or a variance process. We've also reduced the waiting period for peregrine falcon and other sensitive species permit draws from 3 years to two. And we have extended, at the request of the FAA, the eagle endorsement, like I said, for these large raptors, from master class falconers to general class falconers. This makes a big change because it essentially erodes the difference between those two classes because they can now have all the same species. So this is a summary of the list, how we view this list changing. From apprentice class going from about 14 species, which currently is much more liberal than most states in the Pacific Flyway, to 15 species. The general class falconer goes from 14 to 44, the master from 15 to 45, and the one species of eagle currently allowed is the golden eagle. We would add 10 other species globally to be available to general master or master class falconers. The source of these came from discussions with UFA when we looked to put the 14 species list into the rule. There are some objections about this is going to limit opportunity for sportsmen, so we asked what are the species that are commonly used in falconry, and we'll put those on the list too. The division's really all about creating sportsman opportunity where possible. So that was a list of 74 species was presented. We evaluated those for which ones were suitable for falconry and also other criteria that are being used for the CIP rule, which is under revision and will be coming to this group, I guess, fairly shortly. We tried to use a common process for both those rules. And I'm going to cover that in more detail in a sec. So why do we need a list? Typically, state rules are constructed in a way that we prohibit everything except what we allow. So all weapons are prohibited except rifles or archery, but we say you don't have to make a special list because crossbows or air rifles are proposed, right? That's the way the state constructs its rules. There are many ways you can do that. The other way, of course, would be to list the things that are prohibited. You can sort of two sides of the same coin. The way state rules are constructed typically is to have this list of allowable, of exceptions to the blanket prohibition. That's how rules are constructed. So we started with this list in the first place. This list also overlaps with the CIP rule, possession, collection, importation, and possession rule, which basically prohibits the importation of species to the state that are on, let's say, international endangered species list, so to speak. Evaluation of a list also allows the division opportunity to minimize risks, both from disease, from ecological escape. Also covers us in terms of legal and human health and safety issues, that we have due diligence to do that there, too. And fundamentally, though, it's a pre-approved list of species deemed suitable for the sport of falconry, as the state defines it, which is the pursuit of wild game. We were asked to clarify how new species would be added to this list. This is in your current packet. The rule really states that upon application for the COR, the division director will make an evaluation. We ought to give some more clarification on that. So this is how we go about it. This is the same process we use to evaluate that list of 74 in the beginning. So is the species suitable for falconry? If it's an insectivorous nocturnal owl, it's not something that's eight inches tall, a flam-headed owl, or it's not something that can be used to hunt wild game. It's not considered to be a suitable species for falconry. Same goes for a lot of the vultures, the carrion eating birds. They're not suitable for taking of wild game. So those were scratched from that list. That's how the list got from 74 to 54. Does it pose a risk to human health and safety? There's not a lot of evidence to suggest this is a major issue. And also health certificates are required by the Department of Ag for importation for the most part. The last question is not really germane. It's also not that important for Utah. If a species escapes in the wild, can it establish a viable population? Most of the raptor species we're talking about here are not, we don't consider those to be major issues. In Alaska, other parts of the world where you've got, let's say, a listed subspecies of goshawk, it's a concern that you don't want to bring in another goshawk and blur those bloodlines. And that's the gist of it. That's a harpy eagle, one of the species that would be allowed.
Thank you, Russ. I did have a question on that, but I think you answered the question I was going to get, so it looks like you probably certainly had that question. So you did it last there. So other questions by the back? Yep, Mitch?
Russ, I'm going back into the wild. I understand that.
Well, sorry, which slide do you want to go back to?
Well, no, not a slide. As far as I'm going back into the wild, the local birds that can be used, do they have to be caught in the wild? Or can they be raised? It seems like every one time you have to catch them in the wild.
You don't have to take wild birds. You can. Many of the species are regulated by federal rule about what birds can be taken and what ages of birds can be taken from the wild. For example, apprentices are not allowed to take aias or nestling birds from the nest, only general masters.
Can they raise them? Can they raise these birds?
Yes, they can.
And
then you can transfer them to, say, a captive propagation effort too and raise more young, which are then available for sale. Birds that are taken from the wild are considered to remain wild for their lifespan. So they can be returned to the wild, they can be possessed, legally possessed by the falconer, but they remain, they're considered to be a wild bird for the rest of their life.
You're going to Naples. Are any of these raised? Most of them are taken in the wild?
Most golden eagles used in falconry are captive bred. There is an opportunity, there is a legal pathway to get golden eagles for falconry, but it is circuitous, and this is a federal standard. It's quite honestly quite difficult for a falconer to get a golden eagle from the wild. There are many, many hurdles. I can detail those if you'd like.
Russ, if you run into some of these guys with golden eagles, would you have them call me? I've got a proposition.
I think there's an organized group of golden falconers that are that have golden eagles. They met up in Rock Springs not that long ago. And it's not that far away.
Does his have anything to do with Craig? Bill's got a question.
So, we received some emails from the non-falconry public about the species list of 45. But the Corps specifies a species that's allowed to be collected, right?
I'm sorry, who?
So the Corps permit specifies a species that they can collect. They don't have an ability to collect any species out of the 45 just because it's on the list.
No, they do have that ability. Yes, yeah, so COR is at the appropriate level, the apprentice, general, or master. Those falconers are allowed to take any bird that's legally possessible.
On that list of 45?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
With the exception of a peregrine or something.
Correct. There are a couple exceptions to that blanket statement. Peregrine falcons are one of the sensitive species or another where we have the opportunity to limit take for sensitive species, and the federal government limits, because of a court ruling, limits peregrine falcon take. We have an allotment, much like sandhill cranes, from the flyway that we're allowed to allocate.
So did the one blackhawk species, or I'm not even familiar with the species,
common blackhawk,
is it still on the list?
It is still on the list. It is not a state-sensitive species, nor is it a species of conservation concern. However, it is a new It's new to Utah. There's only three or four known nesting locations in the state, and while there's nothing in rule to preclude the take of common blackhawks or falconry at this point, I think the division would like to work with the falconry community to let that species expand, get a toehold better established before you start taking birds.
Okay, thank you.
Other question, Brother Rock.
I have one. Maybe I missed it, too. Under the current rule, without this revision, how many birds are we allowed?
By policy and practice, there are 14 native species in North America, plus exotics and hybrids. The current rule is, this is one of the things that we are exactly trying to fix with this rule revision, because it is unclear. There's a table that sits beside the rule that establishes there are 14 species, how they can be taken from the wild. These are native North American species. And then has some additional language around hybrid and captive bred birds being authorized by the program coordinator, not by the division director or wildlife board. That said, it's not in rule. The language itself is not in the rule, and our AG, Assistant Attorney General Greg Hansen's not here tonight, but I think he would tell you that it puts us in an uncertain ground whether or not the rule and that list is enforceable. If it is not, the backstop to that is the federal rule, which allows anything goes in the worldwide raptor world.
I would just also like to point out, you mentioned the COR. I am a licensed falconer. In my COR, it does not reference that 14 list at all. It references anything in the subfamily Accipitridae and subfamily Falconidae. Now, it's only until recently that I was even aware of this 14 bird list. I remember putting it together when we were revising the list for apprentices back in 2010, and it was never meant to be a list restricting us to those 14 birds when we were putting it together.
When I spoke with the falconry coordinator who put the rule together and ran it through last time, that's my understanding, it came from him, that it was the intent. It's lost in the midst of time. There's not a lot of documentation to be had as to what the intent was. When we put through this process, it's caught a lot of folks by surprise. Whereas the administrators of the program have been assuming that this list has been our policy and practice. There's some exceptions to it, and those exceptions have been made along the way without any real fuss. However, incorporating into the rule, that's where things got sideways. And that's why we actually invited the doctor community to say, if this isn't the right list, what should be on that list? That's how we got to where we are. If we're going to have an inclusive list, let's have it include the species that are desirable, that are commonly used for falconry, that make sense.
I can provide a little insight.
Yeah, you'll have a chance to talk. But you can.
What was the question part when you were asking the question?
Yeah.
First thing you did the question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Melissa. Melissa Wardell. We did excuse you for a few minutes.
What?
We did excuse you for a few minutes.
Yes, and I've actually got to run again because I'm testing for EMT stuff tonight.
Okay.
But I can stay till the hour.
You don't have no label, do you?
No, I don't. I've got a big bird, but he's not an eagle.
Other questions, Brother Rack?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of questions for Russ. Russ, the other states, the surrounding states, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, Nevada. There's quite an increase, going from 14 to 55 species.
To 54, yeah.
Do those other states have some of the same species, or do they have that many species on their falconry rule?
It varies widely across the Pacific Flyway. This is the range of the 11 western states I'm most familiar with through the flyway process. There are some states like Arizona that have basically adopted the federal standard whole heart. So there's no restrictions beyond the federal rule in Arizona, even Nevada as well, Idaho similar to that. But other states like Colorado, Montana, Alaska, California all have other restrictions, either because of conservation species, take very different periods of time, geographic restrictions. Montana's rule doesn't allow importation of any non-native raptors, so they exclude all hybrids and exotic species. Alaska precludes some individual species like goshawks from certain areas because they do have those listed subspecies that they've got to attend to.
The other part of my question is, if some of these non-native eagles, like this is the harpy eagle here,
yes.
If they were to get loose out in the wild, what kind of impact would they have on like our native raptors?
That's unknown. These are events that have never happened, so it's hard to assess our risk. This is really a risk assessment kind of a process where we're trying to develop a process to do our job, essentially, you know, tend to our responsibilities, and manage risks that haven't occurred before. So many species have never occurred in Utah. We don't have that. There's no study, no data to take, to assess. These are very large raptors. I think if they were to escape in the wild, though, it's not going to find a mate. It's going to be lucky to find habitat. When we did the evaluation, if I may, when we evaluate species for authorization, we looked at basically these three criteria. Is it legally possessed and legally possessible? So if it's an endangered species, it's not allowed to be possessed, you know, that's one thing. It gets complicated, though, when you've got something like an Eplomato falcon, which is an endangered species in the U.S. and not possessable. You can't capture it from the wild. However, the range of that species extends into other countries where capture might be legal. You could bring it into a captive propagation program and then acquire an Eplomato falcon that way. They look pretty much the same, though, in the hand. So, again, the second criteria is the suitability of falcons. So, again, small insectivorous nocturnal owls are not suitable for taking wild game. As the state defines sported falconry, and our management purview extends to protected wildlife. That's what the state regulates. We don't regulate the broader concept of falconry, which is maybe less of a sport, more of a lifestyle, but that's the limit of our authority. So when we say that species are suitable for falconry, it's suitable for falconry as we define it, as the state defines it. So nocturnal species, insectivorous species, carrion-eating species like vultures, we don't feel these are suitable for falconry as we define it. The risk assessment qualities, though, are the conservation status, the risk to human health and safety. So if a martial eagle were to escape, or a harpy eagle escapes, is someone going to get hurt if they're trying to, the local law enforcement is going to try and take it off the back of the, you know, soccer net or something? What's the potential for establishment in the wild, and what are the consequences of establishment too? These are all factors that we evaluated. That risk assessment portion is a piece that is going to be common to the CIP rule. We're trying to stay consistent between rules and use that. Again, most of those risk assessment issues are not, we don't feel they're major issues, impediments to bringing birds into Utah, though. And there are other pathways to possession. So if folks want to have a flat-footed owl and fly it, there's another pathway to get that. That's through the CIP rule, or potentially by director approval, direct request, just requesting it.
Okay. And just one last question here. How did this go over in the other racks this week and last week?
Variable. Every rack has voted a slightly different version. Central region accepted the rule as proposed with the exception of the list and rolled it back to the federal three families, three orders there. The northern rack has kind of a hybrid approach. They recommended an action item to convene a public working group and to accept the rule as amended or as proposed with the exception of the rule, but not pushing it back to the current standard. It's a little unclear whether they meant the 14 species or the federal standard. Southern region went same as central, accepted the rule as proposed, but go back to the federal standard as a basement. And last night's Southeastern Region accepted the rule as presented. No amendments.
Other question by the right.
Can you clarify the CIP rule?
The collection, importation, possession rule. So that covers, that's our backstop rule for everything from kangaroos to everything else in the world.
Why would a flagellated fall under that?
Oh, it would not. This is for, that would be covering the importation of exotic species. Clams are local, yeah.
I did have a question on the director approval. How would this go between different directors? What if one director said one thing and the next director decided they didn't like?
I think
the directors
are, well, we've tried to clarify that in our process, by clarifying what the process would be for every director. Directors are also subject to both the policy and politics. I think if they are wildly variable from the previous director, they would probably get an earful. That's a practical observation, perhaps. By the same token, our process is set up so that if a species is evaluated and considered to be acceptable, it gets added to the list. The list will grow. We fully expect that this list is a starting point, not an end point.
So can you clarify when you said the federal list, we're trying to determine, that's not the 14. The federal list is the three families.
Federal list is any all those raptors worldwide. It's over 500 species.
More than, okay. That's a bigger list than the 14.
You bet.
And that's those three words that I can't pronounce. I'll butcher, so
hawks, eagles, owls, all of
them. Other questions? Okay, we'll take questions by the public. If you will, step up to the mic and ask your question.
State your name.
My name is Randy Height. That's a lot louder than I thought it was going to be. So, first question to Russ is about this presentation itself.
I've been
to each one of the I've been to the central and the northern racket meetings. There's a lot of changes in this one.
We tried to be responsive to the questions and to clarify information for the board as we've gone forward. Yes.
So my question is, I mean, I get the feeling from you that this is a work in progress still from the division.
The rule has not changed. The presentation has changed to clarify information.
I understand. We spent a lot of time on making those, and thank you for responding to all of our questions on the rule review. But the list itself is a question. There's a lot of changes in this presentation directly in response to that list. Can you go to the second to the last slide there? No, that was the one showing the impacts.
This
one? No, second to last.
Second to last is... which one do you want? Just describe
the one. The one that said the health, safety, and...
That's actually an extra. This evaluating
right.
process.
So when you were just addressing the board just now, or the rep...
This is on the last page.
You said, I'm sorry, need to keep addressing it. You dismissed each one of these risk assessments right here, and then said that the only reason that you really had for putting this in there is because the list itself sits next to the proclamation on the website, and it needs to be reinstated. Wouldn't it be just if there are no risks that need to be mitigated from this slide, wouldn't eliminating the list from the website be just as effective as...
The process that we applied, the species that we're proposing for to be on this pre-authorized list, are ones that have been evaluated. We're not suggesting that we throw out the whole evaluation process. That's a different result.
Right, and part of that evaluation, I believe, was in effectiveness for euthumerine or taking...
It's suitability. As the state defines this, in that very, one of the early, very early slides, we define the sport of falconry as the pursuit of wild game, the care and training of a bird for that purpose. Wild game, as we define it, though, doesn't include moths, right? And that's just not part of our, that's not what the division is allowed to regulate.
Does it include starlings?
It's, there are also, as you pointed out in the earlier Acts 2, there are a number of logical inconsistencies that are baked into the federal rule. We inherit those whole cloth. American kestrel, in other words, common example, is a common raptor used to train falconers in the care and training of falconry birds. It is not well suited to falconry as we define it. However, it is probably the most common species used by apprentice falconers. It takes mostly insects, maybe occasionally some smaller game, or small, unprotected larva, typically, though.
I'd like to address something in my comments later, but just changing tack just a little bit. Administration is one of our biggest concerns in the falconer community. Interpretation of the rule. How long have you been involved as an avian coordinator over falconry?
I took this position in, what, 2013, 14, right in that room. Yeah.
And how long will you be around to interpret this rule?
Oh, I'm sure it's one day, yeah.
You're not retiring soon? Okay. That is one of our biggest concerns, is the interpretation of the rules that we put in place.
If I may, we are trying to clarify, and have worked to clarify such things as the process. What's the process for evaluating authorization? Trying to clarify that process so it is transparent, repeatable, and not subject to who's in, who's in my seat.
Right.
And that's, or the director's chair as well.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. Love
that
name. Yeah. Other questions by the public?
Hello, my name is Todd Valentine.
What is it?
Todd Valentine. He's a boy.
You have to speak loud into the mic because we have to be able to hear you.
Okay, we'll do. Could I respond to some of the questions or were addressed to?
No, you've got a question for Russ.
Oh.
This is just questions, period, that you get asked. Ask him questions.
I just didn't know.
We don't know. Melissa knows, but she's not. So.
Yeah, I didn't know if you guys wanted responses to the ones.
No, no. Okay.
So, Russ, you said that the group, when you wanted to put animals or listed in the rules, there's a problem, except what we allow isn't that. It was like, the point is, when you want to put animals into the rule to administer it, right now the rule has the three orders of families, and that order, those orders of family, cover legally everything that we do, correct now?
Yes. So with the list of 54 and so list of...
Yeah, that's right. And so the 14 to 54 isn't an increase at all. It's a decrease from what we have. And if we get a list in the rule, then it becomes more excessively burdensome to administer new ones that added, like what you're saying, you're trying to define an approval process, so that's not finished yet. It says that it did, and it says the director can approve it, correct?
It's yes.
Not, those criteria are not in the rule, correct?
No, you requested more clarification on that process, and that's what we have provided. It's potential that might be put forward as part of a final rule to the board. If, again, we're collecting comments and from all the racks as we go. If I can go to your earlier, I think your earlier question was about is this change to 54 species an increase or a decrease? And I think it depends on how you look at the rule. My understanding of how this rule was constructed and the intent of the earlier document was our perspective is that this is an increase to cover virtually all the commonly used species for falconry. I think the perspective of the UFA, I can speak for you, Todd, is that it's a decrease considerably from 500 plus anything goes to 54.
Legally speaking, we're entitled to 500, and there's no restriction. Is that correct?
That is the untested legal waters.
And that's the majority position of all the other states almost in the United States.
I can't speak for all the states. I've only researched the 11 western states and the flyway.
And the ones that surround Utah have the federal language in it for possession? Their neighboring states?
Nevada, Arizona, and Idaho, Duke, Colorado, all are based in the federal. The basic rule is the basin. All states have to start with that and can build on it to meet local needs.
The orders of families were included in all those.
Colorado has limits on that. Montana, as I said.
But the orders of families, even Montana has the orders in the rule, right?
I'm not an expert on Montana's rule, but I reviewed certain sections, and Greg Hansen, who's the AG, has done a more of a legalistic analysis of the surrounding states, but he's not here tonight to speak to that, and I'm not going to try and cover that room.
Okay. When you talked about the 14 birds species and the criteria that are on the webpage on the DWR website, there are birds that have come into the state that, according to the comments on that, would require approval from the division. Is that correct? Like a red-necked chicken?
Yes. There are currently approved species on that list of 26, which is larger than 14, that have been approved.
So what was that process to approve?
Some of those occurred before my time. I couldn't actually tell you what that process was.
So I checked with one of my friends that has them. He's never submitted a request. He's just turned in the 3-186s that say that he's got them. There has been no approval because there's been none required. And I don't think there's been one bird. But when I called the division today and asked how they came up with the number of birds that we might have, but we don't fix any, I was told that it was from the annual report, rapid reports, the falcon reports.
Yes.
And so if they weren't on there, it all come, that would be the current ones, but it wouldn't say history, and that's as much as they had. So wouldn't it be an overstep to say that they've all been approved in the past if we don't know?
I'm not sure I think I lost your question there.
I'm saying that when I was talking about the red-necked Shaheen, we really don't know that if there's been an approval process or not, right?
No, we have I believe it's a red-necked Shaheen, or at least maybe several, that have a valid COR, so it has been approved.
So possession on COR is de facto approval? Is that
yes.
What we're saying?
Yep.
They did go through an approval process. If they got their
COR, that constitutes the approval process. It's insofar as I know. This is, again, these are very long-lived birds, and most of these are before my time.
Yeah.
Okay.
3 minutes.
The process to define birds so that they can be added. Tonight you said that the threat for genetic invasiveness or species, did I say that wrong? Invasive species or genetic integrity for bird get lost and breed is minimal, is what
right.
you
yeah,
said
I,
tonight,
I've
right?
I've had that same conversation with Clayton White too.
So. Okay, so if those criteria are minimal, would they come into consideration for approving birds in the future?
Yes, what we're proposing is a process, not a result. This is a process for evaluation. So new birds being brought into the state would be evaluated by the same process, rather than being a fixed result that's permanent through time.
Okay. I think what I'm trying to point out here is that if there's an undefined process in the rule, and the rule says get an approval from the division, it's lacking in solids. It's not solid. And so it's arbitrary, and it's hard to know as a falconer if I can approach you and get a bird because it's ambiguous. Is there intent to put clarity in the rule so that it doesn't change as administrators go along and we know what the criteria is so that we can know if we can apply?
That is one potential for presentation to the board. We can modify the. I'm not sure how that goes. Again, like I said, this is my first crack here. So, there's potential to, codify this process in rule. If we need to go to that level of detail, I expect we can. If not in this process, then perhaps in a future revision.
Okay. Last night, I'm going to shut up. So you don't think I'm talking. Last night, one of the RAG members, as I understand it, going to the RAC approval stuff. The first RAC clearly said, accept the rule, accept the list. The second RAC said there was some ambiguity, and then they clarified it, and the motion was to accept the rule, accept the list, and put a list to do together.
Okay.
And the third one said, who was the third one? Birkin said,
accept the rule, accept the list.
And the one last night was divided, and the chair had to make the deciding vote and said, the division put a lot of work into it, we should let it happen.
Is there a question?
When the lady last night at the RAC was the vote against it, she was wanting to know if there was a method for birds to come into, on, you know, unapproved lists, unapproved birds to come in. And you said yes. And then afterwards, my question is, the rule says birds 1 through 10 or 1 through 50. And if a one comes in and it's going to be added to the list, does that have to wait for a RAC meeting to be added to the list? And so if this gets approved this year and I want a bird, do I have to wait for 5 years?
That's a good point. I don't know. This is a good question for Greg Hansen, the AG. If a bird, if you set up a pathway to approval that's by director mandate, and the list is in rule, the director can't modify RAC the rule without wildlife board. So I'm not sure how that gets resolved. That's a point we had not anticipated, I guess, in the drafting of this.
Okay. I have more questions. Thank you.
Appreciate
that. Yeah.
Other questions?
Is it okay to ask one more question?
Yeah, but we got that one over. Let him go first, and then we'll get back to you.
I'm Robbie Rowley. I live over in New Shane.
Robbie, what?
Rowley, R-O-W-L-E-Y. I just have one question. That you said that this list would be modified with deemed suitable. What's the process of that deeming suitable, and who is going to be doing that? Right now, the 500 bird list that we have, that my COR says, who's deeming those birds to be suitable? Because the what you talked about, the American kestrel, it doesn't catch anything that is on the wildlife list, on the protected species. But who deems that? Who's making that list? And how did that go to the process?
That's the slide you see up there. That's the process for what they're proposing. It would be by director approval.
So there's a process there, and that's how this list...
Those are the three criteria that we've established and used to evaluate the list of 74 species that the EFA proposed down to the 54 where we end up, where we're walking around.
So from the 500 that's on the list, the species,
We did not evaluate all 500 species. We only evaluated the 74 that were proposed for addition by the EFA. These are the most commonly used, we understood these to be the most commonly used birds used in falconry.
So who was on this board that made that decision, what I'm getting to?
That wasn't a board, that was a director office. We were developing this that criteria at this time. The third criteria, the risk assessment piece, that's a piece of process that we the division, are intended to use also as a backstop for the CIP rule, maintain consistency. The suitability for falconry question, that's something that went through basically an ad hoc process with the director's office.
But you already said that most of the birds on that list, if they got loose while falconing, there would be no risk at all.
I consider the risk of escape to be minimal for the most part. I mean, there's some potential risk to human health and safety. You don't want these things near a daycare center or something, but, you know, it's a... I think the risks are minimal.
You couldn't get one of these birds to come to you if you wanted to. That's ridiculous to think that if they'd get loose and hurt somebody.
We have to attend to public perception as well. I understand the falconry community has a great deal of insight into the behavior of raptors that the general public does not also have.
Thank you, Rodney. Randy.
Sorry, real quick.
State your name again, Randy.
Randy Heights. So
when Todd was asking you about the director's, what was that again, the director's...
The approval process.
Approval process. And he said that there are, and you said that that's in place right now. And we mentioned that there are birds out there that are not on the list that you created, but they have been held as a falconry bird for a number of years.
They already have approved COR, so they are...
So they have approved CORs. Mm-hmm. But they did not have to talk to the director. The director didn't have to say anything. So are you saying that if I brought in an Africa Shakira and reported that on my annual report and I have a COR, that's pre-approved?
If it's already got an approved, if there's already an approved COR for that species, our intent with this is you don't have to, that a single species doesn't have to be continually reevaluated because it's a new instance of the same bird. That's not our intent. Same thing goes with the meets and trials. If we have a national meet, which has been held in Vernal many times over the past, if there are birds coming in from across the world that need to be evaluated because they're not on our currently pre-approved list, they would get evaluated, and our intent is with this that these would be then approved for in perpetuity. However, the question that Todd brought up is there's a tension between rule constructions. Our current rule is flawed. It says that the program director can be making these calls without any kind of process whatsoever, right? This is a director-level approval process that we're trying to be as specific as, and transparent as we can. Our intent is that once the species is evaluated and approved, it's good to go. How that squares with the statute need of rule construction to have the list in the rule proper, that's a legal question I don't have the answer to. I will try and find out, though.
It just needs to be clarified, because I know there are several falconers in the state of Calgary that are not on the list, and it sounded like you were saying that if they've reported them and they're on their, and they have a COR, then they've already got the director's approval on that.
Correct.
Again,
yep.
But again, those are birds that are not on the list that's on there.
Correct. That's the baseline starting point. The current rule is flawed in a number of ways and needs fixing. This is our best attempt to do so.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for clarifying.
Thank you, Randy. Any other questions? State your name if you would, please.
Hi, I'm Mark Housekeeper. I'm a falconer from Lehigh. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the RAC. Thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. My question relates specifically to meets. And so I really, my first NAFA meet that I went to was here in Vernal. It was tremendously successful. Falconers from all over the country and a few from outside of the country came here, and it was tremendous. So is there a separate approval process for, say, somebody wants to show up with a Marshall Eagle or an ornate Hawk Eagle, which there was one here during that particular meet. I'm wondering if those birds aren't on the list, what do you do for that meet? And then how do you address the issue of NAFA getting ticked off and saying, we're never coming to Utah and depriving the community of the economic benefit and cultural opportunities if NAFA gets ticked off and says, screw you, Utah.
I put a slide up behind it helps to, I think, yes, address this. Again, this question came up earlier as well. So for the board, meets and trials are slightly different. Trials are when falconers come together to fly birds on unprotected wildlife, so pen-reared birds or whatever. There's no special permit required. However, for a meet, what we're talking about here is a sanctioned event where our current rule has that the wildlife board has to create an exception, a special hunting season for this 5-day non-resident hunting permit to allow a meet to occur, and birds are brought in. We're proposing there's two processes. One is an individual can, with a Marshall Eagle, could make a direct appeal to the director one-on-one, and that goes the same process. We've also added a bulk approval process for the meet organizers, so they can list, so the falconers who are coming can say what birds they're bringing and have those evaluated by the meet organizers. It's a one-stop process.
Okay, so those birds would be acceptable for that 5-day period in November, and then suddenly not acceptable the day after or the day before?
No, we need to have a consistent and equitable rule. So if a bird's approved for a 5-day visit, it's going to be approved that's part of the long-term approval. That'll be added to the list, so to speak.
Okay. My only concern with that is that it becomes, again, sort of a, you said perceptions improve, important, public perception. It seems to me as a member of the public that it seems arbitrary, and anything arbitrary is subject to the whims of whoever the regime is at the time, that kind of thing. So anyway, I appreciate you attempting to answer that.
Sure. This is the second point of your question. We would welcome a conversation with the North American Falconers Association. We did not receive any feedback from them, so we're happy to have a conversation with that. We certainly don't want to preclude sportsman opportunity and having a meet in Utah. I think the last meet year sold over 75 permits. But that's the conversation that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Come on up.
Thank you. State your name again. Dewitt Patterson. I had last night after the RAC meeting there, one of the questions that came up was concerning the approval. The director, whoever approves a bird, then the question was, does it have to go for permanent approval to the RAC? And I believe your answer was you didn't know. Is that correct?
Correct. I'm going to find out, and we'll get you the board of answers quickly.
So we're really not sure if somebody comes in from out of state with a bird that isn't approved, if they can fly that, or if there's been a bird approved here, let's say that it's been added to, but these lists don't come out that often. Then the question, how does somebody from out of state that's coming in for one of our meets know if they're in compliance with the law here in Utah or not?
We would put that information on the website. The website is content that we can update regularly without having to go through a RAC and board process. However, that's I think an open question right now. I'll chase that down and get back to you as quick as I can.
You mentioned that the birds are like a weapon. And I also, I'm one of the few falconers that actually hunts with a shotgun and a rifle and pistol, the whole thing. But I know that if we went, my question, I guess, is with my one rifle, which is an improved .6, when I fire around through it, it crimps the shell. And it makes it a magnum when I go back and reload it. I have a series of shotguns over and under my old original Irving Johnson. Now, we're looking at a list. If you did the same thing for as you're doing for falcons, that for the gun hunters, what you're saying is each weapon then has to be approved.
I think
there's a Browning, or whether it's an over and under, or whether it's a double barrel, or whatever we have.
The distinction would be in weapon type, perhaps more than individual like forms of shotguns. This would be like shotgun versus rifle versus archery, if you draw the analogy out. The difference also is that wild raptors have a different constituency. Nobody really cares which shotgun you use of your shotguns to go on a approved waterfowl hunt. But there are other constituencies that care quite a bit about which raptor is used.
They care which raptor I kill a pheasant with?
We have other comments from other constituencies, such as the Audubon groups, that have made that point.
Last question. I don't want to take a whole lot here, but one of the things that came up is that if somebody has a bird that it would be that is not on the list, that it would be automatically grandfathered in. But when I'm reading the thing here, it says that it isn't grandfathered in, according to it says all participants in the if a raptor species is removed from the authorized list of a given falconry class, a falconer lawfully possessing such a raptor may receive a COR from the division, and then a bunch of things after that. But is this correct, or do we know that it's going to be grandfathered in?
That the language in the rule that's before the board is our best attempt at a final. That was the intent of the language change. was to make sure that raptors, falconers were protected in case of changes to the rule in the future.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move to, if we don't have more questions, we're going to move to the comment period. If you have comments, you can step up to the mic just like we have, state your name. You'll give, be given 3 minutes, and my illustrious secretary here will let us know when that, if we exceed that. So.
Does the person who speaks for the group get by?
No, not here.
Not here, okay.
We think everybody's special.
Okay, sure. That's fine.
All right. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 comment cards. If anybody else has a comment, I've got
to fill out the card.
We'll go
there.
In this order. We'll go Mark, housekeeper, then Rodney Rowley, Mike Horton, Todd Valentine, and then we'll go with Randy Height. If you still want to fill out a card, you're welcome to fill one out and turn it in before we get done. So, Mark, you're up to bat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mark Housekeeper from Lehigh. I appreciate the efforts of the division. Even today, I had an issue that required division assistance and intervention. I had a captive red bird that needed a band removed and replaced. So they were very helpful. I appreciate working with them. Had nothing but positive conversations. I am pretty deeply concerned for a couple of reasons. One is the ambiguity of the restricted list and the suitability and the arbitrary nature of the production of that list. I'm concerned that individual opinions may, these other constituencies that are not even present here tonight can have their voice be disproportionately heard through other individuals in the future. On the issue of the list, from a practical standpoint, as a falconer, it leaves me with great concerns. I'm very supportive of the verbiage in the new rule, with the exception of the list. And the other thing that concerns me a little bit, just on a philosophical basis, because I spend a lot of my time listening to talk radio and all that kind of stuff while driving around at my job, I'm concerned about administrative creep. I'm concerned about this being kind of a practically kind of a bureaucratic usurpation of the power of the Wildlife Board and the RACs. If the RACs wanted to revisit this issue or have input, like the RAC did this evening about eagles and sandhill cranes, or falconry and sandhill cranes. So, I just would hate to take sort of the populist element of wildlife management in Utah out of it and turn it into a bureaucratic, have it be consumed by bureaucratic creep by taking that authority from, for species and all that kind of stuff away from the RACs and giving it to our unelected but well-meaning folks in government. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Rodney. And then after Rodney, we'll do Mike Horton.
I'm Rodney Rowley. Thank you, Chairman, for letting me come and address you tonight. I also have a great concern about the list. It really is taking the art of falconry and putting it to somebody's subjective rule. But that, like Russ was saying, that risk to human and health safety. That's really, really a stretch to think that there's somebody's going to have a health and safety issue from a falcon, from some raptor, because it just doesn't work that way. Most of these birds are very, very leery of people, not that they're going to be attacking somebody in safety. But I am in support of all the rest of the rule change, other than the list. And I think it would be easier, as Russ said, part of this is to keep the rules short. It's cutting down to 5 pages. With the list, it makes it longer. But with just keeping the simple verbiage of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the three orders of birds, would keep it shorter.
That's all I have. Thank you for your time.
Right. Could I ask you one question?
Yes.
You probably know whoever drew the Falcons lanes there years ago. It kind of started that place.
Yes, yes. Our Brinker often.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I happened to see that one time. They were really great guys and showed me some good experience.
Yes. That's the thing that brings the Falconers together. Is that if you've ever watched any young child, they are magnetized to Falcons. Falconry. Birds of prey are one of those things that are just magnetized to them. The majesticness of them are just, there's no equal. And the education that happens and the things that we run on that we're fearful of, it just doesn't work. And if we bring our friends from the world, all around the world here, and we cut our list to that, 57, we're just hurting the ability of people around the world to come to our state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Roger. Okay. Mike Horton, and after Mike, we've got Todd Valentine.
Yes, as they said, my name is Mike Horton. I am a local. I've lived here my entire life. I've been a Falconer. I guess once a Falconer, always one. I'm always looking at poles, always looking trees, watching raptors. I came here tonight, and in fact, I was a Falconer before Utah had any falconry laws or regulations, and served on an advisory board on instilling some rules and regulations. But what I'm passing out there, this is an intercept from the national, when we say NAFA, nobody really knows what NAFA is. It's North American Falconers Association. And it's like an intercept between him, the president of the national club, and the president of the Utah club. And he's expressing his concerns that any changes in regulations, and by that I mean birds that are allowed into Utah for a national need is worrisome to the national club. And I would like to remind the people here of the board that if we get the availability of an NAFA meet, and I've heard even in 18, they're looking at Utah again, Vernal actually. And this is really a revenue generator from Vernal, and we've been needing some revenue generation for the past couple of years. But when we have a national meet here, it tends to bring from 250 to 300 people. Now, these are the Falconers. These are not just people that come here to watch. So that's in addition, where we're talking that many people for the week of the meet, and that equates to over 500 to 700 hotel rooms. So a conservative estimate that they figured out is 300 people plus attendees at $170 daily for 5 days, and that breaks out over $300,000 to the local economy. And so I know I'm probably running short time here.
6 seconds, you're real close.
Okay. I just like everybody to, you've got names there, don't hesitate on calling up and getting some information for yourself. They'd be happy to attend you and answer your questions, whatever you have. And let's keep the ball rolling and make Vernal a place where the national club desires to come here and have its meetings. And thank you very much.
Mike, before you get away, I believe the NAFA was here about 14 or 15 years ago. They've been here since.
Yes, they have.
Yeah.
14 or 15 years ago?
It was 2007 that they came.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be here every 5 years.
It's not 10 years ago every year, but I know about 14.
They've been here at least twice before.
Thank you. Then Randy. Okay, if you could give me a minute, that'd be great. I'd like this thing about NAPA not saying that they don't like excessive regulations. That's what we feel this is.
Talk so we can understand you because we have to interpret it.
The new list has the following negative impacts. Added complexity. We've discussed some of that tonight. There's undefined criteria, the time frame requirements for new for approval, application processes for NAPA meets. We recommend that a blanket exception be given to NAPA meets. There's no biological problems, but that wasn't granted, and the application process becomes arduous. They said there's no genetic integrity concerns, invasive species concerns, or human and health safety, yet they have that in their evaluation criteria, and that's difficult. It may take years to get a bird added into the new rule because they're unsure if a bird added to the rule would happen then or have to be added through rule. The current system is flexible, non-threatening for invasive species, for genetic integrity. There's no approval processes. It legally meets any state or division requirements. It doesn't add complexity, and the governor has an executive order not to have burdensome aspects of rules added, and if there's no justification for it, it's significant material, then it's a burden. There's also other items we would like to have changed, but we are solely focused on this one list because it's the most important. We recommend that adopting the division's proposal as is, with the exception of the bird list, is what we recommend. Even that is on your sheets in front of you.
One minute,
Mark. Okay, so another question was, where did the list come from? Prior to 2010, this is from the proclamation at the time. It has 14 birds that you can take in the wild. That's how many you can get it. And it had two of the other orders, the falcons, hawks, it was 285 birds. Then it went up to 500 birds. That list of the wild thing was taken out of the rule because in the language in the rule, it's already in there. And we wanted to have something that was to clarify what was in the rule, and that's why where these tables came from on the division. I was the only one who was there to work with Jim Parrish with the division. The division's direction was to adopt the federal rule, that language. That was the official thing. And these were help tables to help us understand what we could have. And that's clearly, we are going from a big circle of birds that we can come from, but we don't use that whole aquaculture, to a limited amount, and that's troublesome with the extra burden. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Tom. Randy Hyde, and he's my last one. No, I got one more.
The name you can't pronounce.
Duarte Pedersen. Duarte Pedersen. Thank you.
First of all, I want to give a proper introduction to myself. My name is Randy Hyde, and I want to know who got a hold of my email program and got that letter out of there. Somebody's got that, but that's fine. I actually have been working with the NAPA group, and their attorney and the president and their secretary as well. They are very concerned about the preservation of falconry in North America. Falconry, the description of falconry, our description of falconry is so much more broad than the divisions. And we do need to preserve that heritage, that cultural heritage that has many of our ancestors practiced in the old countries. And we work to preserve falconry in North America. Please do not let this list pass. We don't have any problems with the changes that were made to the rule. Please do not let this list pass. it has no place in falconry. Falconry's definition is so much more broad than catching wild game or protected game. Not everything's going to catch a rabbit or a deer or elk. Sometimes those starlings that haunt your farms, that eat half of your livestock feed, you get those flocks of hundreds and 200s, thousands of birds. I catch 9,000 a year of those birds in traps, and I sell them to falconers to feed their birds. Using merlins to catch, is not defined as falconry, but it is falconry in its purest form. Watching those undulating flights, chasing and catching one bird, that is falconry. Our biggest problem with the division that we've had over time is interpretation of the rules. So many rules have been put into place, and then somebody else comes in and says, oh, this is what that person meant. For example, upgrades. Getting somebody going from an apprentice to a general, but also making sure that we get the training that we need. That became interpreted as, you can't start a falconry program until you actually catch a bird. That doesn't have anything to do with the reading, the studying, the training, the going out in the field with your sponsor. So that ended up being a 3-year apprenticeship instead of a 2. Also, I want to let you know that I represent about 256. That comes from his slide. We recently had an election because my term was up. And it fell right along the lines of those that were convinced that there was a list of 14 birds that the division had to enforce, and those that were not convinced that we could fight it because they were more experienced and they've seen this come up before and they've seen this fought and brought down. It's never been brought to the Iraq war before because they're in court and play nice and drop it. We need to play nice and we need to drop this list. They'll accept the correct changes to the proposal as is. But 2/3 of those 256 voted in favor of fighting the list. So keep that in mind, that there is a large group, large consistency that is fighting within that list. Thank you.
Question, Mr. Chairman. How much do you get out of starting? How much out of credit?
I bet you get a dollar for it. Oh, my God.
All right, you heard that way.
Again, like everybody else, I'd like to thank you for your patience and listening to this. It's been, I'd like to thank Russ. And we tend to beat him up on this one issue, but he's really a good guy. And my father was part of the division on the head badge number 16. And I love this area. I had numerous commercial properties over in Roosevelt, and I still have a place in Hanna. So I feel like I'm one of you in a lot of ways that way. There's, I think, some of the concerns that have been brought out here. Last night at the RAC, one of the RAC members said, he asked me, he said, is your concern that the government is continuing trying to encroach on us more and more? And I said, yeah. And I guess the thought is, if it ain't broken, don't try to fix it. And part of this was broken. And Russ has done a great job, I think, in fixing that portion. I think what we're doing is, if we're going away, we're trying to make this list, and nobody really knows, you know, what they're going to include or not include, or how we get it, or what's going to happen. Why don't we stay with what has been working? It is not broken. All of the states basically around us may have one little tweak that mentioned in Alaska. They didn't want another type of a goshawk coming in because they had that. But other than that, they accepted the federal rule. Arizona has accepted it. Nevada's accepted it. Idaho's accepted it. Wyoming's accepted it. I mean, you go right down. I really don't know of any of the lower 48s that have not. The only one that doesn't even allow falconry is Hawaii. So, I mean, that doesn't exist. Don't include this list. It's so complicated. We have problems in that. They said make it less complicated. Let me tell all folks one little story. I captured a bird when we had to go and have them banded by the division. And I took it down to North Temple to the head of the falconry there at the time. And I during the conversation, I was telling them about the number of Merlins that were out that year. There were so many, and I had captured a little Merlin. And she banded it for me, and I went out to the car. Now, this is the head of the falconry, the expert, okay? Went out to the car, and I looked at my COR, and on it was an American Kestrel. You know, the sparrow hawk, the most common bird here. She did not recognize the difference. I had to go back in and have that changed. Now you're trying to enforce, have law enforcement go out and differentiate. They don't know the difference from half the red tail. They differ from birds that weigh almost 5 pounds to some that are 2 pounds, and they come in every color size, everything else. The only expert probably are the falconers, and there aren't that many that could identify all of these 500 anyway. And it doesn't matter. There's no impact. Keep it simple. I say keep it simple, stupid. Again, thank you for your time and everything that you have done.
Did you call me stupid?
Yes. No. My wife will use that one for me.
The list applies to him, but not all right.
I appreciate all those comments. Thank you. Yes, yeah, we're back to the RAC discussion on it.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask that we, or motion that we take a 5-minute break before we come to the RAC discussion?
Yes, let's take a 5-minute break. We'll come back at 9 o'clock. That gives us 6 minutes.
All right. Thank you.
Sorry, we kept you so long.
Well, this is normal for us.
You want some more water?
Yeah. It's been like this every night? Pretty much.
Oh, no, that's not fun.
Well, you know, this is a public process. This is how it goes. The public that's showing up is...
Did your other guys leave you?
Yeah.
There you go. You're good.
Yeah, they took off.
They presented it to me.
Yeah, who has the stuff?
that I know it does. It's so much stuff. You just say, okay, you can have these.
So it's your job to try and get all this down. My name is Mike Horton.
Tanya, nice to meet you. Yeah, I'm the new Ron Stewart, so I'm the public conservation outreach manager. So I'm in charge of making sure that we get all this down, because we need to be able to have this on the portal when we send it to Salt Lake. And because we take notes, and it's hard to understand people a lot of the time.
It is.
So people want to hear you. So I have to crack a whip.
That's all right. Yeah. You know, some of them like to dance around the microphone. They ought to just take it out.
I know. Well, I'm working on the process of making that a little easier for everybody. But yeah, I mean, some days it works, and some days it just doesn't. So, this is what I inherited, so this is what we're working on. But those are definitely things we'll take into consideration. Yeah. So, can I talk into it now?
I don't have any stuff in these interpreters.
That's funny. Oh no, you're falconless.
Yeah. I've been for so long.
I'm a birder, so I understand the passion behind what you guys are doing. Because birds are my passion. So what do you think about all this?
So what do you think about all this?
I definitely enjoy my raptors a lot. And being in Utah, from Ohio, we travel all over the country. So it's supposed to be like we have our fair share of different raptors, which is fun. So we should have a raptor symposium here. I'd be okay with that. So all your guys in thought.
I talked to Jimmy at length about
it. I'll get into one of them.
I want to be sure if the ground is
all here. But yeah, and there's lots of different things. The rule is not clear.
Well, it was probably a 3D process. It didn't work to double check that carefully at the end. But there's stuff that needs to be squishy. It's on the first appearance. We never really figured that out until we actually started doing the hard look at it.
I would love to do that with you guys. And is this all part of the collaborative I'll grab my card.
I hope we can get some. This year, I don't know, maybe we got some traction this year. I haven't heard back yet.
But you tried to find the
Lady speaks.
Okay, let's announce back to Russ in the rack. So, Russ, you got a little bit you want to talk, and then I think we've got a few more questions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I was able to get a hold of Greg Hansen, the Assistant Attorney General, who had helped draft this rule. And to clarify the point that Todd brought up about how do we square the list of approved species that goes to the RAC and board process with additional species that would be added by director approval. What you and the board are voting on is giving the director approval to modify the list so that when he does make changes, those are carried forward. How that would be conveyed could be through a website, something like that would be an appropriate way of conveying that information then in a timely fashion. And the intent was to make the process more flexible so you would not have to wait for a rack and board process to make those changes come into effect.
And you reverse it?
Well, Todd, this is our show now.
Sorry, I should be directing my comments to the board, Steve.
All right, let's go. Let's go with questions or comments for Russ. Anybody got anything for Russ before we just talked out?
Thanks, Chairman.
Mitch?
Russ, I got a concern. When you guys put this together and put your list together, apparently you never consulted this group at all. Is that correct?
No, sir. We've been meeting regularly since July of last year.
There's have been involved, yeah?
Yes, sir. We've had over 10 informal meetings, 3 semi-formal open houses. We've had attendance up in the 50s. This has been a long, lots and lots of other consultations with individuals and email traffic and late-night texts.
Kind of perplexed me a little bit how many questions they still had and how much of it they still didn't understand. And think of all them meetings, it's a little more hashed out.
We worked through a number of issues, and I think we've incorporated a number of recommendations from the community. This was the point where you agree to disagree, I suppose. Because of the way state rules are constructed, we understand we're painted into a bit of a corner because we have to have a list of exceptions. And so we've tried to make this as amenable as we can. And to make that process transparent and repeatable, we've had to put a bunch more structure in there, a lot more rules to kind of clarify how it's going to happen. And that's kind of where we are, how we got to where we are. Does that answer your question?
I have a couple questions. One, did you say there was a UFA list with 74 species on it?
Correct. When we started the discussion around should we put this, we're going to need to fix our rule construction, which is inappropriate right now. That was when we said, well, what if 14 is not right, what's right? What's the appropriate? What are the species you want to have? And that's where the 74 came from.
From them.
Correct. Okay. Yep. And that was, then we went through, we evolved this process of this is what you see on the board here.
It started with the list.
Correct.
Yep. Does the 74 pretty much encompass all the raptors in the state?
Yes, it does, entirely.
So the several hundred, they're not in Utah?
No.
That's all the questions I have.
Other questions for Russ?
Not for us. It's for Brian.
Okay. Brian, step up with the mic. This is more fun than you know.
Hi.
We don't get to hear from you very often.
I don't come with you very often. So.
Well, you're the only biologist here. I was just.
For
our region, I'll put it that way. For our region, do you have any concerns with the list or going to the accepting the whole federal?
I've talked with Russ, and we reviewed somewhat the, as he was going through his process. For me and my program, the concerns that we addressed, through his process was with the sensitive species and species that were, conservation concern, things like that. That's the ones that I'm the most concerned about for my job entirely, and also with Boundary. So we kind of walked around. I know what all the raptors look like in Utah. And I can identify them pretty readily. Spent a lot of time with Friedrich's hawks, conservation of Friedrich's hawks, burrowing owls, things like that. So those are the ones I've been most concerned about, but I think it's all in part of this.
So what's your concern about them? Education?
Well, that's what my job is, to focus on those species that have lower numbers. Like Friedrich's hawks, in this part of the state, we might have 10 to 14 nests that we know about each year. That's it.
And so what's falconry's impact on those sensitive species?
I'm not sure of the total impact on some of those species.
how many are collected.
So it's more of a collection issue, not so much a handling issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Were they removed? The sensitive ones, are they part of the ones that were removed from 74 to 54, or are they still on the 54?
Many are still on that list as approved species. We tried to err as much as possible to be inclusive. However, there is a stipulation in there, which is carried over from the current rule, to allow the division to put limits on how many and where capture permits are allowed for conservation species. So if there's concern around Fruitious Hawks in the basin, for example, we could put a cap on that. Like peregrine falcons, they'll only allow 17 birds taken from the nest statewide. That same process. However, for example, this last year, though, while the populations are relatively low in the basin, Fruitious Hawks are keeping their treading water statewide, so we did not put any limits on Fruitious Hawk take.
I got a question then. So this list is not a handling list. This list is a take list. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correct?
It's complicated. It's both. It's capture and possession for native species, and it's importation and possession for exotic species. Both of those are avenues to propagation as well.
So are those take permits issued on an individual basis by the state?
To an individual falconer, yes, but they are not for individual species. We don't typically find out what bird has been captured on a capture permit that's been issued until we get the annual report, which you heard referenced before is the 3-186. It's a federal form. That's their annual report. So until that gets submitted, we don't actually know what's been captured.
So would it not be easier to issue the capture basis? I'm thinking if it's a sensitive species issue, that you would regulate those species from being captured on an individual basis, and the falconers would release upon capture if they were not permitted for that bird. But I have a hard time understanding the handling side of that.
The current rule and the proposal before you both have that potential in there. So if we have a concern around Fruitious Hawks in the basin, we can cap that at this point. That's already in the rule, and I don't think anyone's really brought that up as a point of contention. We haven't needed to exercise that because they're doing okay. And the impacts of falconry take are quite low for the most part. So our concerns around the conservation issue aren't, we haven't had to exercise that. They're doing okay.
What's from your couple of other racks voted to go to the three family thing against the proposal? What are your major concerns if the Wildlife Board does that?
It puts us into this situation where we have a logical inconsistency between what the state defines as falconry and birds that are held in possession, purportedly for falconry, but that don't meet our own criteria. That's a challenging and difficult place to be in. We foot in both worlds there. There are some issues like that, with the Kestrels brought up before, that are baked into that federal rule. We can't avoid those. We're trying not to create any more, though. It's not a pathway to, well, this is brought up in the other sort of pejorative language, it's not a pathway to pet ownership, right? But we also have to recognize the sport of falconry is as we define it here, the broader lifestyle of falconry is much bigger than that, and that's harder, but that's beyond our purview to regulate.
Thank you. Other questions?
Maybe a question for the falconers. How many different species, through the 265 people in the organization, how many species would that cover right now? I mean, do you guys all own the same style? I mean, out of your 265 people in Utah, how many German short-haired dogs are there for
the he's going to walk in a sled.
Because I'm trying to understand that from a bird hunting perspective.
Thank you for those support. This is the state's breakdown of what we have. 253 permitted falconers, 276 permitted individual birds as permitted from the COR that we hold and the annual report. But as far as I know, none of these non-native species that are listed here, shows 16 native to North America and 10 non-native, none of those went through the directive approval process. Those are just included in those three families that you can see on pages 2, 3, and 4 on the handout that I gave you. They're already permitted. Didn't have to have an approval process in there. But there are species like the lantern falcon, sacred falcon, lantern falcon from...
there's one less of those now.
Just one night, just from the whole zoo, the wolves. I can guarantee the wolves will be watching that every day, waiting for them to have it. But the seeker, the very common one, Optimato, is very common. There's a lot of species. And I also want to point out that this list was created from annual reports that haven't been looked at for quite some time because the state didn't have a database. The list was created before the database was really organized. And I understand it's working now. It's working pretty good. So we have that. And that's a good thing for the administration if this does go into effect, because that would be necessary. But it was put together without really the knowledge of these rules right here. And also addressing that list. Your question was, how did the list come? Did you work with the UFA? He did work with the UFA up to a point. But you have to understand what had happened, the background on that. A letter came out and said, there is a list of 14 birds that you're allowed to use. We've been using everything we could. Didn't really know that 14 birds was actually native birds that could be taken from the wild. Didn't really have to do with how you're using them or handling them. But it created a problem when they put it on the website. We didn't have anything to do with that. That didn't go before the board. And now they're saying that they've got a conflict because it's there. It just needs to be removed to resolve that conflict. But about a third of the falconers were convinced that the state has all power and that they could enforce that 14 bird list. They could make us get rid of 12 different species. And live with that list. We were under threat that's what's going to happen. So a good good-sized group worked with the state to make sure that we could live with if they took that overreach and created that list. But that's why you're seeing the conflict here. Nobody really wanted that list. Nobody really wanted to create that list, but they did out of fear. And that's why we're finding it, because it doesn't happen.
That's what I'm confused about, is there's 26 and 14 and 74 and 500. I'm like all over the place on how many birds are we talking about. So I'm confused right now.
16,
so.
Okay, thank you. So Russ, back to you. Out of those 26 raptors that are in use in Utah, there's 16 of them on the list. Is that right? 16 species on...
All the ones that are currently permitted in Utah are on that 54 list. And all the species that are currently in use are also currently permitted. So they are already, that 14 is where we started with the old rule, but it's already expanded at this point. I will say that the species concept is a little bit squishy here because raptors readily hybridize, so you can crossbreed them, and you rapidly get into murky water when you start losing the species concept. Mm-hmm. It's hard to count. Like, what's, is a deer falcon, peregrine falcon cross a different species than either a deer falcon or a peregrine? Do you count it separately? Is that three birds or is that two? One and a half. That's
Okay, other questions, comments?
Yeah, I'm kind of like Joe down there. I mean, I've around hounds. Uncle Cy taught a poodle to fetch waterfowl. I mean, that's... I'm
a little taken on regulating what verbs can be used. If I wanted to use a Rhodesian Ridgeback to chase a mountain lion, I can do it. But I don't know.
It is a good idea.
What else? I wouldn't have to worry about shooting a lion. I think it's obvious.
Please do, Brett.
All right, I'll play the devil's advocate here. Just so you know, I raise rare birds, and I have endangered species that I raise. I have an elk ranch. Boy, don't let me pick up any elk calves. I have permits for everything, from endangered species to state core to state ag, elk with microchips on individual animals. So I'm not talking, I'm going to do a different perspective. I want the neatest bird, the rarest bird. I'm assuming the falconers want one nobody else has also. So I'm concerned about the conservation status more than anything else, about the impact on the rare ones. Because I'd be very surprised if that's not what you want. Whether there's an impact or not, that's a whole other debate. I'm just going to tell you my opinion here, okay? So my personal opinion is I'm very concerned about the tone toward Russ tonight, repeatedly. And I think the DWR has done a commendable job in a tough situation. And Utah Falcon Association started with a list of 74, and now they're arguing for several hundred. So I'm, whether we vote for a list or not, I think the things got out of hand, the discussion. That's
what I'm other comments? Mitch, I know you're dying to make one.
I'll make a comment. Not to totally disagree. Give me on the phone.
Yeah. I would love to do that.
I feel that the fact that they presented a good fight, they brought up a lot of issues, and then this one, the DWR, hasn't resolved a few of these issues. All these have had to come before us. My take is that maybe they haven't done their job completely. We need a little more work at this point. So that's kind of my concerns. The DWR hasn't convinced me that they've done their homework and done their job and worked with these people to get a plan that everybody's happy with. It still sounds to me like it needs a few more ingredients that needs to be baked a little longer. So that's my take, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mitch. Other comments? We don't have any other comments or discussion. We need to go towards motion. So I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make the motion, Mr. Chairman. I make the motion to accept all the DWR changes to the factory rules presented, with the exception of the restricted lift of 54 active species. This for active species. It's been in place since 2010.
Speaking to the mic. Take that mic.
I make this motion.
The motion was on that very handout. The motion is that we accept all the DWR changes to the Falconry rule as presented in the reception of the restrictive list of 54 raptor species. And instead of that list, revert to the current Utah Falconry rule permissive list of raptor species that has been in place since 2010. Any raptor species of the order, and I'm not going to say those three words. Yes. That's most sad. All right, so we got a motion on the table. Do we have a second?
I second that motion.
Okay. Giorno, second that motion. Discussion?
Yes. Clarification. So when we say back to this list, we're not talking 14, we're talking the three primary species of predator.
Back in the 500 list.
Yes.
That's correct. Right, Russ? That's the 500 worldwide.
That's my understanding of the motion proposed by UFA.
And how long would that be in effect?
Until the next RAC and board.
As far as revision. This was visited the last time 10 years ago?
No, it was actually 6 years ago now, I believe. The rules need to be taken out for RAC and board review every 5 years at a maximum. They can go out much more frequently than that. They can come out every year. I mean, you go out on some of these annually.
So are you thinking, well, I guess that's later. Everything seems to be 3 years around here, so.
Other discussion? Okay, we've got a motion and a second. All in favor?
Who's second?
Second was Joe Arnold.
Joe Arnold.
Oh, okay.
We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in favor. Those opposed. 1.
All have to abstain due to the fact that these animals are very sacred to our people, and for me, that animal shouldn't be caged. You know, so I'm going to abstain.
You don't want to vote against it?
No, I'll abstain.
Okay.
So 5-1.
Mine, I can see both sides. So I'm still trying to figure out which way to go.
So you guys got any money? I guess it's not going to matter if you vote against it or for it because we've got 5 in favor and that's going to pass.
I'll just abstain from it then.
2 abstentions, 1 opposed, and 5 in favor. Motion carries. Okay, we've got a couple, we've got one order of business that isn't on the agenda that those who want to leave can be excused. It's mainly just a RAC issue, but I'm going to turn the time over to Boyd Blackwell. What?
You can call me whatever you want. Secretary, yes.
And unless you're secretary, he's got a business he needs to do. Oh, but by the way, before he does that, I want to let you guys know that this is off the record, by the way, Roy. At the law of my board meeting last time, the chairman, the board chairman, invited the lawyer up and asked him a question. He says, is the chairman able to make a motion? And he went through his spiel and basically said, it's not against the rules, but it's not our proposed or a process we use. And he said, very well, thank you. And then he made 3 or 4 motions.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Because he wanted to.
Yeah, because he's got one more meeting that he's the chairman, and then he's obviously, he served his time, he's off, so he was trying to get his agenda passed.
Okay, guys. With the year coming around, our fiscal year coming around, we made some changes. Some of them, you can serve on this for 4 years, and then we beg you to stay, and so we get to have you for 8 years, and then you have to go. And we figured you served enough, and so we cut you loose and give you a break. We've had, Joe, we've asked to stay. Dan, we asked to stay. And then we had,
Jerry left.
Oh, yeah, Jerry left. And our new representative for the elected official, yeah. And Dave was the other one that we asked to stay. But Jerry left, so we have a new one, and it'll be the... Brad Horrocks, the county commissioner, represented elected official. So those are the changes that we'll be moving forward with. I want you to know I appreciate you guys staying. You've all done a great job. This has been an awesome RAC.
You guys ask such great questions, never take anything for granted, and I really, really appreciate that. Now, here we are with Mitch.
You told me 6 years.
With Mitch.
You told me 6 years.
With Mitch, we want to present him his name tag. We'd take that home and put it on his door.
That was a bad one.
But I got to tell you, I really appreciate Mitch. He took this job very seriously. He was here to almost all the racks. He worked hard and served with distinction and honor, and we appreciate it.
Well, let's say after about the third year.
Yeah.
That's
what they say,
you
got. So, we want to present Mitch with this, and I know that this elk has a great deal and has a big place in his heart. And I've done a lot of things with Mitch that dealt with elk, and we want to present this to him from the division and for all of the effort that he put in for 8 long years.
That is a pretty good song. Thank you.
So, with that, I'll turn the time back over to the chairman, and our next rack will start anew. There'll be a training coming up in June, and I think it's the day before the board meeting, and so there's a rack training. You're all invited to come, and we'd love to have you there.
Right.
Being Salt Lake. I don't know yet. I think they have moved it around in a couple of places. The last one was at Shields.
Yeah.
So, but thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate all of you.
I have one last question.
You can ask a question.
Have you decided on who's going to replace him? Because you have some good candidates.
Some good candidates, and I submitted a recommendation, and it hasn't been approved yet, so
I'm going to say.
Yeah. But
you got some good men.
Yeah, both of them were really good. And so, and like I said, I submitted a recommendation. It's still the director's office. What I do is I submit a recommendation. It goes to the director and also DNR director, Steiger. And they get together and they say yes, and they'll get a letter. They should, because it's kind of down the road for another month or so. Yeah. Okay.
You guys
have to No. We affect each other too much. We have to have you here. So you're lucky.
Can I get a motion to adjourn?
I motion that we adjourn.
David had the motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Melissa,
since
second.
I wasn't here for anything.
I wish you'd here for the discussion. Too bad. All right, all in favor?
Aye.
We're going to call it
a good one. I'll get my name on the schedule.